This is Audible.
Bantam Audio Publishing presents a Turner Bantam Audio production of Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, winner of the Turner Tomorrow Fellowship. The first time I read the ad, I choked and cursed and spat and threw the paper to the floor. Since even this wasn't enough, I snatched it up, marched into the kitchen, and shoved it into the trash. While I was there, I made myself a little breakfast and gave myself some time to cool down. I ate and thought about something else entirely, that's right. Then I dug the paper out of the trash and turned back to the personal section, just to see if the damn thing was still there. It was, "Teacher seeks pupil. Must have an earnest desire to save the world. Apply in person." An earnest desire to save the world. Oh, I like that. An earnest desire to save the world. Yeah, that was splendid. You will doubtless wonder, why is this man so indignant, so bitter? That's a fair question. The answer goes back to a time a couple of decades ago when I'd had the silly notion that the thing I most needed in the world was a teacher. That's right. I imagined I needed a teacher to show me how one goes about doing something that might be called saving the world. It came about in this way. During the children's revolt of the 60s and 70s, I was just old enough to understand what these kids had in mind, and just young enough to believe that they might actually succeed. It's true. Every morning when I opened my eyes, I expected to see that the new era had begun, that the sky was a brighter blue and the grass a brighter green. I expected to hear laughter in the air and to see people dancing in the streets. Not just kids. Everyone. Then one day, when I was in my mid-teens, I woke up and saw that the revolt had dwindled away into a fashion statement. I was disillusioned and bewildered, and in my innocence, I thought there must be someone out there who could set me straight, a teacher, so I looked for one. Silly as it sounds now, that's what I did. I looked until I wised up and stopped making a fool of myself. And now, years after I'd given up this search, here was some charlatan advertising in the paper for the very same young dreamer I'd been 15 years ago. I know this doesn't really explain my outrage. Let it go. I was being irrational. It happens. It's allowed. I had to go, of course. Had to satisfy myself that it was just another scam. 30 seconds would do it. A single look. 10 words out of his mouth. Then I would go home and forget about it. When I got there, I was surprised to find it was a very ordinary sort of office building. I'd expected something a little more atmospheric. Brownstone with paneled walls, high ceilings, and shuttered windows, perhaps. I was looking for room 105, and I found it in the back, where a window would overlook the alley. The door was uninformative. I pushed it open and stepped into a large, empty room. That was my first impression, emptiness. The second was olfactory. The place reeked of the circus. No, not the circus, the menagerie. Unmistakable, but not unpleasant. I looked around. Against the wall at the left stood a small bookcase containing 30 or 40 volumes, mainly on history, prehistory, and anthropology. A lone overstuffed chair stood in the middle, facing the wall at the right. There was something odd about the room, but it took me another look round to figure out what it was. In the wall opposite the door stood two tall windows admitting a feeble light from the alley. The wall to the left was blank. The wall to the right was pierced by a large plate glass window, but this was plainly not a window to the outside world, for it admitted no light at all. It was a window into an adjacent room. Because it was backed by darkness, the glass in this window was black, opaque, reflective. I made no attempt to see beyond it. As I approached, I was the spectacle under observation. On arrival, I continued to gaze into my own eyes for a moment, then rolled the focus forward, beyond the glass, and found myself looking into another pair of eyes. I fell back, startled. And then recognizing what I'd seen, I fell back again, now a little frightened. The creature on the other side of the glass was a full-grown gorilla. Full-grown says nothing, of course. He was terrifyingly enormous. A boulder, a sarsen of Stonehenge. His sheer mass was alarming in itself, even though he wasn't using it in any menacing way. On the contrary, he was half-sitting, half-reclining, most placidly nibbling delicately on a slender branch he carried in his left hand like a wand. I didn't know what to say. You can judge my confusion by this fact, that it seemed to me I should speak, excuse myself, explain my presence, justify my intrusion, beg the creature's pardon. I felt it was an affront to gaze into his eyes, but I was paralyzed, helpless. I could look at nothing else in the world but his face, more hideous than any other in the animal kingdom because of its similarity to our own, yet in its way more noble than any Greek ideal of perfection. As my fear began to ebb, I said to myself that there was nothing to keep me there, that I should go home. But I didn't like to leave without accomplishing anything at all. I looked around thinking I'd leave a note if I could find something to write on, but there was nothing. Nevertheless, this search brought to my attention something I'd overlooked in the room that lay beyond the glass. It was a sign or poster hanging on the wall behind the gorilla. It read, "With man gone, will there be hope for gorilla?" This text stopped me. Words are my profession. I seized these and demanded that they explain themselves, that they cease to be ambiguous. Did they imply that hope for gorillas lay in the extinction of mankind, or in mankind's survival? With man gone, will there be hope for gorilla? It was, of course, a koan, meant to be inexplicable. It disgusted me, because the magnificent creature beyond the glass was evidently there just to serve as a sort of illustration for this koan. You really ought to do something about this, I told myself angrily. And then I added, it would be best if you sat down and were still. I listened to the echo of this strange admonishment as if it were a fragment of music I couldn't quite identify. I looked at the chair and wondered, would it be best to sit down and be still? And if so, why? The answer came readily enough. Because if you are still, then you will be better able to hear. Yes, I thought. That is undeniably so. For no conscious reason, I lifted my eyes to those of my beastly companion. As everyone knows, eyes speak. A pair of strangers can reveal their mutual attraction in a glance. His eyes spoke, and I understood. My legs turned to jelly, and I barely managed to reach the chair without collapsing. But how? I said, not daring to speak the words aloud. What does it matter? He replied as silently. It's so, and nothing more needs to be said. But you, I sputtered, you are... I found that having come to the word, I could not speak it. He nodded, acknowledging my difficulty. I am the teacher. We gazed into each other's eyes, and my head felt as empty as a derelict barn. And then he said, "Do you need time to collect yourself?" "Yes," I cried, speaking aloud for the first time. "Will it help you to listen to my story?" "Indeed it will," I said. "But first, if you will, please tell me your name." He stared at me for a while without replying and without expression. Then he proceeded as if I hadn't spoken at all. "I was born somewhere in the forests of equatorial West Africa," he said. "Do you happen to know the methods of Frank and Osa Johnson?" I looked up, startled. I've never even heard of them. They were famous animal collectors of the 30s. Their method with gorillas was this. On finding a band, they would shoot the females and pick up all the infants in sight. "How terrible," I said. without thinking. The creature replied with a shrug. I have no actual memory of the event, though I have memories of earlier times. In any case, the Johnsons sold me to a zoo in a small northeastern city, where I lived for several years. He paused and nibbled absent-mindedly on his branch for a while, as if gathering his thoughts. In such places, he went on at last, where animals are simply penned up, they are almost always more thoughtful than their cousins in the wild. This is because even the dimmest of them cannot help but sense that something is very wrong with this style of living. I don't mean that they acquire powers of ratiocination, but the tiger you see madly pacing its cage is nevertheless preoccupied with something a human would certainly recognize as a thought. And this thought is a question. Why? Why, the tiger asks itself, hour after hour, day after day, year after year, as it treads its endless path behind the bars of its cage. It cannot analyze the question or elaborate on it. If you were somehow able to ask this creature, why what, it would be unable to answer you. Before long, I too began to ask myself why. Being neurologically far ahead of the tiger, I was able to examine what I meant by this, at least in a rudimentary way. I remembered a different life that was interesting and pleasant. By contrast, this life was boring and never pleasant. Thus, in asking why, I was wondering why life should be divided in this way, half of it interesting and pleasant, and half of it boring and unpleasant. In this way, my interior life began, quite unnoticed. Although I knew nothing of it, the Great Depression was taking its toll on all aspects of American life. Zoos everywhere were cutting back. To make a long story short, I was sold to the owner of a traveling menagerie with an empty wagon to fill. You might imagine that life in one cage is like life in any other cage, but this isn't so. At the zoo, the public was kept well away from us. At the menagerie, I was in contact with the public from the first moment. A small group of visitors approached my wagon and immediately began speaking to me. I was astounded. At the zoo, visitors had talked to one another, never to us. I simply didn't know what to make of it. The next day, paying more attention to what they were saying, I noticed that when visitors came to the wagon beside mine, occupied by a female chimpanzee, they cried out, "Zha zha, zha zha, zha zha." But when they came to my wagon, they called out, "Goliath, Goliath, Goliath." By small steps, I soon understood that these sounds in some mysterious way attached directly to the two of us as individuals. You who have had a name from birth can hardly imagine what a revolution this produced in me. It would be no exaggeration to say that I was truly born in that moment, born as a person. From the realization that I had a name to the realization that everything has a name was not a great leap. You might think a caged animal has little opportunity to learn a language, but this isn't so. Menageries attract families, and parents are incessantly schooling their children in the arts of language. "Look, Johnny, there's a duck. Can you say duck? Duck? Do you know what a duck says? A duck says quack, quack." I only had to listen in order to learn. Several years passed in this way. Then, one rainy day, when the lot was deserted, I received a peculiar visitor, a lone man who looked to me ancient and shriveled. Even his approach was distinctive. He stood at the menagerie entrance, glanced methodically at each wagon in turn, then headed straight for mine. He paused at the rope, planted the tip of his walking stick in the mud, and peered intently into my eyes. I've never been disconcerted by a human gaze, so I placidly returned his stare. Several minutes passed. I remember feeling admiration for this man, so stoically enduring the drizzle that was streaming down his face and soaking his clothes. At last he straightened up and gave me a nod, as if he'd come to some carefully considered conclusion. "You are not Goliath," he said. With that he turned and marched back the way he'd come. I was thunderstruck. Not Goliath? What could it possibly mean to be not Goliath? It didn't occur to me to say, well, if I'm not Goliath, who am I? A human would ask this question because he would know that whatever his name, he is assuredly someone. I did not. On the contrary, it seemed to me that if I wasn't Goliath, then I must be no one at all. As I felt it, my awareness of selfhood had been pronounced a delusion. I drifted into a sort of fugue state, neither aware nor unconscious. An attendant came round with food, but I ignored him. Night fell, but I didn't sleep. The rain stopped and the sun rose without my noticing. Soon the crowds came, calling out, "Goliath, Goliath," but I paid no attention. Several days passed in this way. Then one evening I took a long drink from my bowl and fell asleep. A powerful sedative had been added to my water. At dawn, I awoke in an unfamiliar cage. At first, because it was so large and strangely shaped, I didn't even recognize it as a cage. It was circular and open to the air on all sides. As I later understood, a gazebo had been modified to serve the purpose. Except for a large white house nearby, it stood alone in an attractive park I imagined must extend to the ends of the earth. I was still exploring my new home when, around mid-morning, I looked up and saw that I was not alone. A man was standing just beyond the bars, blackly silhouetted against the sunlit house in the distance. I approached cautiously and was astonished to recognize him. As if reenacting our former encounter, we gazed into each other's eyes. I saw that, dry and freshly dressed, he was not the elderly person I'd taken him for. His face was long, dark, and bony. His eyes burned with a strange intensity, and his mouth seemed set in an expression of bitter mirth. At last he nodded, exactly as before, and said, "Yes, I was right. You are not Goliath. You are Ishmael." Once again, as if everything was now finally settled, he turned and walked away. And once again I was thunderstruck, but this time by a feeling of profound relief, for I'd been redeemed from oblivion and made whole again. My benefactor was a wealthy Jewish merchant of this city, a man by the name of Walter Sokolov. On the day he discovered me at the menagerie, he'd been out walking in a kind of suicidal gloom that had descended on him a few months before, when he learned that his entire family had been swallowed up in the Nazi Holocaust. His wanderings led him to a carnival set up at the edge of town, and he went in without thinking. Because of the rain, most of the booths and rides were shut down, giving the place an air of abandonment that accorded well with his melancholy. At last he came to the menagerie, whose chief attractions were advertised in a series of lurid paintings. One of these, more lurid than the rest, depicted the gorilla Goliath, brandishing the broken body of an African native as if it were a weapon. Perhaps thinking that a gorilla named Goliath was an apt symbol for the Nazi giant that was then engaged in crushing the race of David, Walter Sokolov decided it would be satisfying to behold such a monster behind bars. He went in, approached my wagon, and by gazing into my eyes soon saw I was no relation to the bloodthirsty monster in the painting, and indeed no relation to the Philistine tormentor of his race. He found it gave him no satisfaction to see me behind bars. On the contrary, in a quixotic gesture of guilt and defiance, he decided to rescue me from my cage, and fashion me into a dreadful substitute for the family he had failed to rescue from the cage of Europe. The owner of the menagerie was agreeable to a sale. After letting me settle in for a day in my new surroundings, Mr. Sokolov again visited the gazebo, and we gazed at each other in a long silence as before. Finally, reluctantly, as if surmounting some daunting interior barrier, he began to speak to me, not in the jocular way of visitors to the menagerie, but rather as one speaks to the wind or the waves, uttering that which must be said, but which must not be heard by anyone. As he poured out his sorrows and self-recriminations, he gradually forgot the need for caution. After an hour, he was propped up against my cage with a hand wrapped around a bar. He was looking at the ground, lost in thought, and I used this opportunity to express my sympathy, reaching out and gently stroking the knuckles of his hand. He leapt back, startled and horrified, but a search of my eyes reassured him that my gesture was innocent of menace. Alerted by this experience, he began to suspect that I possessed real intelligence, and a few simple tests convinced him of this. Satisfied that I understood his words, he leapt to the conclusion that I should be able to produce some of my own, and decided to teach me to talk. I'll pass over the painful months that followed. Neither of us understood that the difficulty was insurmountable, owing to a lack of basic phonic equipment on my part. But at last a day came when I couldn't go on, and in my anguish at not being able to tell him this, I thought him this, with all the mental power I possessed. He was stunned, as was I when I saw that he'd heard my mental cry. I won't burden you with all the steps of our progress once full communication was established between us. They're easily imagined. Over the next decade, he taught me all he knew of the world, the universe, and human history. And when my questions went beyond his knowledge, we studied side by side. And when my studies carried me beyond his own interests at last, he cheerfully became a sort of research assistant to me. By the early 60s, I was like a house guest who needed very little attention from his host. So Mr. Sokolov began to be seen again in society. Soon he was engaged to be married. The prospect of marriage pleased him, but he made a terrible mistake in anticipation of it. He decided our special relationship would be kept secret from his wife. It wasn't an extraordinary decision for those times, and I wasn't sufficiently experienced in such matters to recognize it for the error it was. I moved back to the gazebo, but from the first, Mrs. Sokolov viewed me as a peculiar and alarming pet, and began agitating for my removal. Luckily, my benefactor was used to having his own way and made it clear that my situation was unalterable. A few months later, he dropped in to tell me that his wife, like Abraham's Sarah, was soon going to present him with a child of his old age. "I anticipated nothing like this when I named you Ishmael," he told me. "But rest assured, I won't let her cast you out of my house the way Sarah cast your namesake out of Abraham's house." Nevertheless, it amused him to say that if it was a boy, he would name him Isaac. As matters turned out, however, it was a girl, and they named her Rachel. Wisely or foolishly, my benefactor decided I would be the girl's mentor, and wisely or foolishly, I was delighted to please him in this way. In her father's arms, Rachel spent nearly as much time with me as with her mother, which of course did nothing to improve my standing with that person. Because I was able to speak to her in a language more direct than speech, I could soothe and amuse her when others failed, and a bond gradually developed between us that might be likened to the one that exists between identical twins. Mrs. Sokolov looked forward to the day when Rachel would begin school, for then new interest would make her a stranger to me. When this didn't happen, she renewed her campaign to have me sent away, predicting that my presence would stunt the child's social growth. Her social growth remained unstunted, however, even though she skipped no fewer than 3 grades in elementary school and 1 grade in high school. She had a master's degree in biology before her 20th birthday. On the death of my benefactor in 1985, Rachel herself became my protector. There was no question of my remaining in the gazebo. Using funds provided for this purpose in her father's will, Rachel moved me to a retreat prepared in advance. In the years that followed, however, I found I was not content to retreat. I wanted somehow to advance into the very center of your culture, and I proceeded to exhaust my new protector's patience by trying one bothersome arrangement after another to achieve this end. It was not until 1989 that things came clear at last. I finally comprehended that my vocation was to teach, and finally devised a system that would enable me to exist in tolerable circumstances in this city. He nodded to let me know that this was the end of his story, or as much of it as he meant to tell. There are times when having too much to say can be as dumbfounding as having too little. I could think of no way to respond gracefully to such a tale, so finally I asked a question. "And have you had many pupils?"
"I have had 4, and failed with all 4.
"Oh, why'd you fail?" He closed his eyes to think for a moment.
"I failed because I underestimated the difficulty of what I was trying to teach, and because I didn't understand my pupils' minds well enough."
"I see," I said. "And what do you teach?" Ishmael selected a fresh branch from the pile at his right, examined it briefly, and then began to nibble at it, gazing languidly into my eyes. At last he said,
"On the basis of my history, what would you say I was best qualified to teach?"
I told him I didn't know.
"Of course you do. My subject is captivity."
"Captivity?"
"That's correct."
I sat there for a minute. Then I said, I'm trying to figure out what this has to do with saving the world."
Ishmael thought for a moment. "Among the people of your culture, which want to destroy the world.
Which want to destroy? No one specifically wants to destroy the world.
And yet you do destroy it, each of you. Each of you contributes daily to the destruction of the world.
Yes, that's so.
Why don't you stop?
I shrugged. Frankly, we don't know how.
You're captives of a civilizational system that compels you to go on destroying the world in order to live.
Yes, that's true.
Oddly enough, Ishmael said, it was my benefactor who awakened my interest in the subject of captivity, and not my own condition. As I indicated, he was obsessed by what was then happening in Nazi Germany.
Yes, that's what I gathered.
Are you by any chance a student of the German people under Adolf Hitler?
A student? No. I've read about it some.
In that case, perhaps you already know what Mr. Sokolov was at pains to show me, that it wasn't only the Jews who were captives under Hitler, the entire German nation was a captive, including his enthusiastic supporters. Some detested what he was doing, some just shambled on as best they could, and some positively thrived on it, but they were all captives.
I see what you mean.
What was it that held them captive?
Well, I suppose it was Hitler's charisma.
Charisma certainly wins people's attention, but after that you have to have something to say. What did Hitler have to tell the German people?
I pondered this for a few moments without any real conviction. Apart from the Jewish business, I'm not sure.
What he had to tell them was a story.
A story?
A story in which the Aryan race, and the people of Germany in particular, had been deprived of their rightful place in the world, bound, spat upon, raped, and ground into the dirt under the heels of mongrel races, communists, and Jews. A story in which, under the leadership of Adolf Hitler, the Aryan race would burst its bonds, wreak vengeance on its oppressors, purify mankind of its defilements, and assume its rightful place as the master of all races.
True, I said.
After nearly 2 decades of degradation and suffering following World War I, this story had an overwhelming appeal, and it was reinforced by propaganda and an intensive program of education of the young and re-education of the old.
True.
Many recognized it as a grotesque fantasy, but they were nevertheless held captive by it, because the masses around them thought it sounded wonderful, and were willing to give their lives to make it a reality. Whatever you thought, you had to play your part, you had to take your place in the story. The only alternative was to escape from Germany entirely.
True.
Do you understand why I'm telling you this?
I'm not sure.
I'm telling you this because the people of your culture are in the same situation. Like the people of Nazi Germany, they are the captives of a story.
I sat there blinking for a while.
I know of no such story, I told him at last.
You mean you've never heard of it?
That's right.
Ishmael nodded.
That's because there's no need to hear of it. There's no need to name it or discuss it. Every one of you knows it by heart by the time you're 6 or 7. Black and white, male and female, rich and poor, Christian and Jew, American and Russian, Norwegian and Chinese, you all hear it. And you hear it incessantly. Because every medium of propaganda, every medium of education pours it out incessantly. And hearing it incessantly, you don't listen to it. There's no need to listen to it. It's always there, humming away in the background. So there's no need to attend to it at all. In fact, you'll find it's hard to attend to it. But once you know this story, you'll hear it everywhere, and you'll be astonished that those around you don't hear it as well, but merely take it in. A German who couldn't bring himself to take a place in Hitler's story had an option. He could leave Germany. Germany, after all, was the only place where that story was being enacted. Things are not so easy for you. If you don't like the story that's being enacted in your culture, you're out of luck. Because anywhere you go in the world, you'll find the same story being enacted. For you, there is no escape.
Yes, that's true.
Mother culture teaches you that this is as it should be. Except for a few savages scattered here and there, all the peoples of the earth are now enacting this story. This is the story man was born to enact. And to depart from it is to resign from the human race itself, is to venture into oblivion. Your place is here, participating in this story, putting your shoulder to the wheel, and as a reward being allowed to live. To step out of this story is to fall off the edge of the world. There's no way out of it, except through death. Yes, that's the way it seems. Abruptly, as if we'd reached some expected destination, Ishmael held up a leathery black hand and told me, "Tomorrow." There are nights when I wake up at 2 o'clock, and that's it for sleep. And that night was one of them. The time passed, dawn came, I showered, ate breakfast, drove downtown. The building was still there, the office at the end of the hall was still there. When I opened the door, Ishmael's huge, meaty aroma came down on me like a thunderclap. On wobbly legs, I walked to the chair and sat down. My gorilla teacher studied me gravely through the dark glass, as if wondering if I was strong enough to be taxed with serious conversation. When he made up his mind, he began without preamble of any kind, and I came to know that this was his usual style. "It is my most heartfelt fantasy to travel just once in your world as you do, freely and unobtrusively, to step out onto a street and take a taxi to the airport, where I would board a flight to New York or London or Florence. Much of this fantasy is spent in making delicious preparations for the journey, in pondering what must accompany me in my luggage and what may be safely left behind. You understand that I would be traveling in human disguise. If I take too much, it will be a burden. On the other hand, if I take too little, I will forever be having to break my journey to pick up things along the way, and that will be even more tiresome." "True," I said, just to be agreeable. "That's what today is for. We're packing a bag for our journey together. I'm going to throw into this bag some things I won't want to stop and pick up later on. These things will mean little or nothing to you right now. I'll just show them to you briefly and toss them into the bag. That way you'll recognize them when I take them out later on."
"Okay."
"First, some vocabulary. Let's have some names, so we don't have to go on talking about the people of your culture and the people of all other cultures. I'm going to try a new pair of names with you. You're familiar with the expression, take it or leave it. Do the words takers and leavers used in this sense have any heavy connotation for you? I mean, if I call one group takers and the other group leavers, will this sound like I'm setting up one to be the good guys and the other to be the bad guys?"
"Well, they sound pretty neutral to me."
"Good. So henceforth, I'm going to call the people of your culture takers, and the people of all other cultures leavers."
I hummed a bit. I have a problem with that."
"Speak."
"I don't see how you can lump everyone else in the world into one category like that."
"This is how it's done in your own culture, except that you use a pair of heavily loaded terms instead of these relatively neutral terms. You call yourselves civilized, and all others primitive. You're universally agreed on these terms. People in London and Paris and Baghdad and Seoul all know that whatever else separates them, they are united in being civilized and distinct from Stone Age people scattered all over the world. You recognize that whatever their differences, these Stone Age peoples are likewise united in being primitive."
"Yes, that's right," I said. "The point is made. Takers and leavers is fine with me."
Ishmael went on. "Second, the map. I have it. You don't have to memorize the route. In other words, don't worry if at the end of any day you suddenly realize you can't remember a word I've said. That doesn't matter. It's the journey itself that's going to change you. Do you see what I mean?"
"I'm not sure."
Ishmael thought for a moment. "I'll give you a general idea of where we're heading, then you'll understand.
Okay. Mother Culture, whose voice has been in your ear since the day of your birth, has given you an explanation of how things came to be this way. You know it well. Everyone in your culture knows it well. But this explanation wasn't given to you all at once. No one ever sat you down and said, here is how things came to be this way, beginning 10 or 15 billion years ago, right up to the present. Rather, you assembled it like a mosaic, from a million bits of information presented to you in all sorts of ways. You assembled it from your parents' table talk, from cartoons on television, from Sunday school lessons, from textbooks and teachers, from news broadcasts, movies, novels, sermons, plays, newspapers, and all the rest. Are you with me so far? I think so. This explanation of how things came to be this way is ambient in your culture. Everyone knows it, and everyone accepts it without question. Okay? As we make our journey here, we're going to be re-examining key pieces of that mosaic. We're going to be taking them out of your mosaic and fitting them into an entirely different mosaic, into an entirely different explanation of how things came to be this way. And when we're finished, you'll have an entirely new perception of the world and of all that's happened here. And you don't have to remember how that perception was assembled. The journey itself is going to change you. Right, I see what you mean now. Third, he said, definitions. These are words that will have a special meaning in our discourse here. First, story. A story is a scenario interrelating man, the world, and the gods. Okay. Second, to enact. To enact a story is to live so as to make the story a reality. In other words, to enact a story is to strive to make it come true. Okay. Third, culture. A culture is a people enacting a story. A people enacting a story. And a story, again, is a scenario interrelating man, the world, and the gods. Okay, so you're saying that the people of my culture are enacting their own story about man, the world, and the gods. Exactly. But I still don't know what that story is. You will. For the moment, all you have to know is that two fundamentally different stories have been enacted here during the lifetime of man. One began to be enacted here about 3 million years ago by those we've agreed to call levers, and is still being enacted by them today as successfully as ever. The other began to be enacted here some 10,000 years ago by those we've agreed to call takers, and is apparently about to end in catastrophe. Ah, I said, meaning I know not what. If Mother Culture were to explain human history in these terms, it would sound something like this. The levers were chapter one of human history, a long and uneventful chapter. Their chapter ended some 10,000 years ago with the birth of agriculture in the Near East. This birth opened chapter two of human history, the chapter of the takers. It's true there are still levers in the world, but these are anachronisms, fossils, people living in the past, people who just don't realize that their chapter of human history is over. Right. This is the general shape of human history as it's perceived in your culture. I would say so. As you'll come to see, what I'm saying is quite different from this. The levers are not chapter one of a story in which the takers are chapter two. The levers and the takers are enacting two separate stories based on entirely different and contradictory premises. Ishmael scratched the side of his jaw thoughtfully. I think our bag is packed. As I said, I don't expect you to remember everything I've thrown into it today, but that's all right. If I pull out something tomorrow that I put in today, you'll recognize it instantly, and that's all that matters. Well, okay, I'm glad to hear it. We'll make this a short session. You can spend the rest of today groping for the story the people of your culture have been enacting in the world for the past 10,000 years. Do you remember what it's about? About? It's about the meaning of the world, about divine intentions in the world, and about human destiny. Well, I can tell you stories about these things, but I don't know any one story.
It's the one story that everyone in your culture knows and accepts. It's an explaining story, like how the elephant got its trunk or how the leopard got its spots.
Okay.
And what do you suppose it explains?
I have no idea.
I've already told you. It explains how things came to be this way, from the beginning until now.
I see, I said, and stared out of the window for a while. I'm certainly not aware of knowing such a story.
Ishmael pondered this for a minute or two. Do the people of your culture seem to you to be terribly distressed about the destruction you're inflicting on this planet?
No, for the most part, they're taking it pretty calmly.
One of my pupils explained their calmness this way. They're calm because they believe what they've been told.
I said, yes?
What have they been told that keeps them calm?
I don't know.
They've been told an explaining story. They've been given an explanation of how things came to be this way, and this stills their alarm. This explanation covers everything, including the deterioration of the ozone layer, the pollution of the oceans, the destruction of the rainforests, and even human extinction. And it satisfies them, or at least it pacifies them. They put their shoulders to the wheel during the day, stupefy themselves with drugs or television at night, and try not to think too searchingly about the world they're leaving their children to cope with.
Right.
You too have been told this story, this single story that explains how things came to be this way, though it apparently doesn't satisfy you as well as it satisfies most.
Well, I understand what you're saying, I said, but the fact remains that I don't know any such story, not any single story.
It's a single, perfectly unified story. Think mythologically.
What?
I'm talking about mythology, of course. Any story that explains the meaning of the world, the intentions of the gods, and the destiny of man is bound to be mythology.
Well, that may be so, but there's nothing like that in our culture, nothing that could be called mythology, unless you're talking about Greek mythology or Norse mythology.
I'm talking about living mythology, not recorded in any book, recorded in the minds of people and being enacted all over the world, even as we sit here and speak of it.
Again, there's nothing like that in our culture.
Ishmael's tarry forehead crinkled into furrows as he gave me a look of amused exasperation. This is because you think of mythology as a set of fanciful tales. I'm not talking about fanciful tales. I'm talking about ideas that shape your habits of thought and direct your lives from cradle to grave.
Okay.
Let's cut the assignment down to a more modest size. This story, like every story, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Before tomorrow, try to find the beginning of the story.
The beginning of the story?
Yes, think anthropologically.
I laughed. What does that mean?
If you were an anthropologist after the story being enacted by the Alawa Aborigines of Australia, you'd expect to hear a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Okay.
What would you expect the beginning of the story to be?
I have no idea.
Of course you do. You're just playing dumb.
I spent a minute trying to stop playing dumb.
Okay, I said. I guess I'd expect it to be their creation myth.
Of course.
But I don't see how that helps me. Then I'll spell it out. You are looking for your own culture's creation myth.
I stared at him balefully.
We have no creation myth, I said.
That's a certainty.
When I arrived the next morning, I found a tape recorder resting on the arm of my chair.
What's that for? I asked.
It's for recording for posterity the curious folk tales of a doomed culture which you are going to tell me.
I laughed and sat down. I'm afraid I haven't as yet found any curious folk tales to tell you.
No creation myth?
We have no creation myth, I said again. We have an account of creation, but it's certainly not a myth.
Tell it.
then we'll know. I sighed, turned on the recorder, and a few minutes later began. Steady state, or Big Bang, the universe started a long time ago, 10 or 15 billion years ago. And then 6 or 7 billion years ago, our own solar system was born. Life appeared in our ancient oceans about, 5 billion years ago?
3.5 or 4.
Okay. Bacteria, microorganisms evolved into higher forms, more complex forms, which evolved into still more complex forms. Life gradually spread to the land. Slimes at the edge of the oceans, amphibians. The amphibians moved inland, evolved into reptiles, and the reptiles evolved into mammals. That was 1 billion years ago?
250 million years ago.
Okay. Anyway, the mammals, small critters in small niches under bushes in the trees. From the critters in the trees came the primates. Then, 10 or 15 million years ago, one branch of the primates left the trees, and I ran out of steam.
The broad outlines will do, Ishmael said. Just the story as it's generally known, as it's known by bus drivers and ranch hands and senators.
Okay, I said. Well, one thing led to another. Species followed species, and finally man appeared. This was about 3 million years ago.
Is that it?
Well, that's it in outline.
Ishmael nodded and told me to turn off the tape recorder. Then he sat back with a sigh and gave me a long, inscrutable look. And you, an intelligent and moderately well-educated person, would have me believe that this isn't a myth?
What's mythical about it?
I didn't say there was anything mythical about it. I said it was a myth.
Maybe I don't know what you mean by a myth.
I'm using the word in the ordinary sense.
Well, then it's not a myth.
Certainly it's a myth. Listen to it.
I rewound the tape, played it back, and said, well, it's not a myth. You could put that in an 8th grade science text, and no one would quibble with it, leaving aside the creationists.
I agree, he answered. As I said, the story is ambient in your culture. Children assemble it from many media, including textbooks.
Well, then what? Are you saying this isn't a factual account?
It's full of facts, but their arrangement is mythical.
I don't know what you mean.
You've obviously turned off your mind. Mother culture has crooned you to sleep.
Are you saying evolution's a myth?
No.
Well, then what is it?
You're not thinking, said Ishmael. You've recited a tale you heard 1,000 times, and now you're taking a nap. He watched me scowl a while and then said, all right, I'll tell you a story of my own, and maybe that'll help. This story takes place 500 million years ago, at a time when this planet would be unrecognizable to you. Nothing but wind and dust stirred on the land. Even the seas were eerily silent. But of course there was an anthropologist on hand. What sort of world would it be without an anthropologist? One day, as he walked by the ocean, he saw something bobbing in the waves offshore. It was just a squishy blob, but it was the only living thing he'd seen in all his journeys, so he waded out and greeted the creature politely. Soon they were good friends. He explained he was a student of lifestyles and customs, and begged his new friend for information of this sort, which was readily forthcoming. And now, he said at last, I'd like to get on tape some of the stories you tell among yourselves.
Stories? The other asked.
You know, like your creation myth.
We have an account of creation, the other said, but it's definitely not a myth.
Oh, certainly not, the anthropologist said, remembering his training at last. I'd love to hear it. So the creature agreed to tell its story. The universe, it said, was born long ago, 10 or 15 billion years ago. Our own solar system appeared some 2 or 3 billion years ago. Then, after 1 billion years or so, life appeared on this planet. For millions of centuries, it was just microorganisms floating helplessly in a chemical broth. But little by little, more complex forms appeared. Single-celled creatures, slimes, algae, polyps, and so on. And finally,
the creature said, turning quite pink with pride as he came to the climax of his story, and finally jellyfish appeared. Nothing much came out of me for 90 seconds or so, except waves of baffled fury, and then I said, "You've made some sort of point, but I don't know what it is." "You don't?" Ishmael demanded. "The jellyfish's account of creation ends this way, and finally jellyfish appeared. What does that mean?"
"It means this was the final act of creation. There was no more to come. This is what it was all leading up to, the whole 10 or 15 billion years of creation. Jellyfish."
"Exactly. Your account of creation ends with very similar words, and finally man appeared. And what does that mean?"
"It means the same, that there was no more to come, that creation had come to an end, that this is what it was all leading up to."
"Of course, everyone in your culture knows this. The pinnacle was reached in man. Man is the climax of the whole cosmic drama of creation."
"Yes."
"When man appeared, creation came to an end. Its objective had been reached. There was nothing left to create."
"That's the unspoken assumption."
"It's not always unspoken. The religions of your culture aren't reticent about it. Man is the end product of creation. Man is the creature for whom all the rest was made. This world, this solar system, this galaxy, the universe itself."
"True.
But did the entire cosmic process of creation, in fact, come to an end 3 million years ago, right here on this little planet, with the appearance of man?"
"No, of course not."
"Then why did you tell it that way?"
"I guess because that's the way it's told."
"That's the way it's told among the Takers. It's certainly not the only way it can be told."
"Yes, I can see that now.
So what are we to make of this story?"
I bared my teeth in a rueful grin.
"It's a myth.
Incredibly enough, it's a myth."
Ishmael gazed at me. "I said yesterday that your story is about the meaning of the world, divine intentions in the world, and human destiny. According to this first part, what's the meaning of the world?"
"According to this story, the meaning of the world is that it's the birthplace of man."
"Of course, the Takers regard the world as a sort of human life support system, as a machine designed to produce and sustain human life."
"Yes, that's so."
"Supposing there is a divine agency behind creation, what does this story reveal about the gods' intentions?"
"Well, basically, the whole thing was for man. The gods created the universe so they could create us. If they hadn't wanted us, they wouldn't have bothered."
"Clearly," Ishmael said, "man must be a creature of enormous importance to the gods. But this part of the story doesn't reveal their intentions toward him. They must have some special destiny in mind for him, but it isn't revealed here."
"True.
Every story is based on a premise, is the working out of a premise. The story of the Takers is the working out of this premise. The world was made for man."
I blinked over that for a moment and said, "I can't quite see why it's a premise."
"The people of your culture made it a premise, took it as a premise. They said, what if the world was made for us?"
"Keep going."
"Think of the consequences of taking that as your premise. If the world was made for you, then what?"
"Well, I see what you mean. If it was made for us, then it belongs to us, and we can do what we damn well please with it."
"Exactly. Every morning the people of your culture wake up and say to themselves, well, the world was made for us, so what shall we do with it today? That's what's been happening here for the past 10,000 years. You've been doing what you damn well please with the world."
"Yes," I said, and thought for a second.
"Actually, that's pretty amazing. I mean, you hear this 50 times a day. People talk about our environment, our seas, our solar system. I've even heard people talk about our wildlife. And just yesterday you assured me that there is nothing in your culture remotely resembling mythology."
"True, I did."
"Yesterday I said your story provides you with an explanation of how things came to be this way. What contribution does this first part of the story make to that explanation?" Well, I guess it contributes this. Things came to be this way because the world was made for man. If it had been made for jellyfish, things would be different. So it's not our fault if the world is messed up. It's the gods' fault.
Ishmael smiled. You're beginning to get the idea.
Okay, I said when I arrived the next day, I think I have the middle and the end of the story down pat.
Ishmael nodded, and I started the tape recorder.
The world was made for man, I began, but it took him a long, long time to figure that out. For nearly 3 million years, he lived as though it had been made for jellyfish. He lived like a lion or a wombat.
What does that mean, to live like a lion or a wombat?
It means to live at the mercy of the world. It means to live without having any control over your environment.
I see. Go on.
Okay, in this condition, man could not be truly man. He couldn't develop a truly human way of life. So during the early part of his life, actually the greater part of his life, he just foozled along, getting nowhere and doing nothing. There was a key problem to be solved. Man couldn't get beyond a certain point living out in the open as a hunter-gatherer, always moving from place to place in search of food. He had to settle down, had to have a permanent base from which to build. Well, what stopped him from doing that? What stopped him was the fact that if he settled down in one place, he'd starve. As a hunter-gatherer, he'd simply clean the place out. There'd be nothing left to hunt and gather. To achieve settlement, man had to learn one fundamental manipulation. He had to manipulate his environment so that this food exhaustion didn't occur. He had to manipulate it so that it produced more human food. In other words, he had to become an agriculturalist. This was the turning point. The world had been made for man, but he couldn't take possession of it until this problem was solved, and he finally solved it 10,000 years ago, back there in the Fertile Crescent. This was a very big moment, the biggest in human history to this point. The limitations of the hunting-gathering life had kept man in check for 3 million years. But with agriculture, those limitations vanished, and his rise was meteoric. Settlement gave rise to division of labor. Division of labor gave rise to technology. With technology came trade and commerce. With trade and commerce came mathematics, literacy, science, and all the rest. The whole thing was underway at last, and the rest, as they say, is history. And that's the middle of the story.
Very impressive, Ishmael said. You realize that the big moment you've just described was the birth of your culture?
Yes.
Yesterday's part of the story revealed what the world means to the takers. It's a human life support system.
Right.
Today's part of the story is about the destiny of man. Clearly, it's not his destiny to live like a lion or a wombat. What is his destiny, then?
A man's destiny is to achieve, I answered, to accomplish great things, to build civilization.
You're thinking historically. We're looking for mythology. As we saw yesterday, creation wasn't complete when jellyfish appeared. According to your mythology, it was complete only when man appeared.
Right.
Why was it incomplete without man? Why did it need man?
I don't know.
Think about it. What was the world like without man?
Well, it was just a jungle.
You mean nature red in tooth and claw, dragons of the prime that tear each other in their slime?
That's it.
Without man, the world was unfinished, was just nature. It was in chaos, in a state of primeval anarchy. It needed what?
It needed someone to come in and straighten it out, someone to put it in order.
And what sort of person straightens things out? What sort of person takes anarchy in hand and puts it in order?
Well, a ruler, a king.
Of course, the world needed a ruler. It needed man.
So now we have a clearer idea what this story is about. The world was made for man, and man was made to rule it.
Yes, that's very obvious now. Everyone understands that.
And this is what?
What?
Is this fact?
No, I said. It's mythology. Ishmael shifted position and went on. You say it took man a long time to realize he was meant for greater things than could be achieved living like a lion or a wombat. For 3 million years, he was just one more creature rolling in the slime.
Right.
He only realized about 10,000 years ago that he had to lift himself out of the slime and straighten this place out. But the world didn't meekly submit to his rule, did it?
No.
The world defied him. So he had to do what to it?
What do you mean?
If the king comes to a city that will not submit to his rule, what does he have to do?
He has to conquer it.
Of course. In order to make himself the ruler of the world, man first had to conquer it.
Good Lord, I said, you hear this 50 times a day. You can turn on the radio or the television and hear it every hour. Man is conquering the deserts. Man is conquering the oceans, the atom, the elements, outer space.
Ishmael smiled. Of course man is conquering space and the atom and all the rest. According to your mythology, this is what he was born to do.
Yes, that's clear now.
Now the first two parts of the story have come together. The world was made for man, and man was made to conquer and rule it. And how does the second part contribute to your explanation of how things came to be this way?
Well, I said, once again, this is a sort of sneaky way of blaming the gods. They made the world for man, and they made man to conquer and rule it, which he eventually did, and this is how things came to be the way they are.
All this is just the result of man achieving his destiny.
Yes, I answered him. That's how it's understood. People just shrug and say, well, this is the price that had to be paid for indoor plumbing and central heating and air conditioning and automobiles and all the rest.
And what are you saying? I'm saying that the price you've paid is not the price of becoming human. It's not even the price of having the things you just mentioned. It's the price of enacting a story that casts mankind as the enemy of the world.
We have the beginning and the middle of the story together now, Ishmael said. Man's finally beginning to fulfill his destiny. The conquest of the world is underway.
And how does it end?
Well, let's see, I said. With agriculture came settlement and division of labor. With division of labor came technology. With technology came trade and commerce. With trade and commerce came mathematics, literacy, science, and all the rest.
Okay, man's destiny was to conquer and rule the world. And this is what he's done.
Almost.
He hasn't quite made it. And it looks as though this may be his undoing. The problem is that man's conquest of the world has itself devastated the world. We've poured poisons into the world as though it were a bottomless pit, and gobbled up resources as though they could never run out. It's hard to imagine how the world can survive another century of this, but nobody's really doing anything about it. It's a problem our kids will have to solve, or their kids. And there's only one hope. We have to increase our mastery of the world. All this damage came from conquering the world, but we have to go on conquering it till our rule is absolute, and then all will be well. We'll have fusion power, no pollution. We'll turn the rain on and off, grow a bushel of wheat in a square centimeter, farm the oceans. All the planet's life processes will be where they belong, in our hands. That's where it stands right now. We have to carry the conquest forward, and this will either destroy the world or turn it into a paradise, into the paradise it was meant to be under human rule. And if we manage to do this, if we finally manage to make ourselves the absolute rulers of the world, then nothing can stop us. Then we move into the Star Trek era. Man moves out into space to conquer and rule the entire universe. And that may be man's ultimate destiny. That's how wonderful man is. Once again, that was excellent, Ishmael said. But you realize, of course, that if you'd been telling this part of the story 50 years ago, you'd have spoken only of the paradise to come. The idea that man's conquest could be anything but beneficial was unthinkable. Until the last 3 or 4 decades, the people of your culture had no doubt that things were just going to go on getting better and better and better forever.
Yes, that's so.
However, one element of the story has been left out, and we need it to complete your culture's explanation of how things came to be this way. So far, we have this much. The world was made for man to conquer and rule, and under human rule, it was meant to become a paradise. This clearly has to be followed by a but. It's always been followed by a but, because the takers have always seen that the world was far short of paradise. True, let's see. How's this? The world was made for man to conquer and rule, but people screwed it up. Yeah, the way it's seen is people were bound to screw it up. Being human, they were bound to screw it up.
But why, being human, were they bound to screw it up? Ishmael asked.
It's because there's something fundamentally wrong with humans, something that makes them stupid and destructive and greedy and short-sighted.
Of course, everyone in your culture knows this, but how did the takers come to this conclusion, the conclusion that there's something fundamentally wrong with humans? What evidence were they looking at?
Well, I'd say they were looking at the evidence of human history.
What human history? Were they looking at Homo habilis and Homo erectus and Homo sapiens?
No.
You know they weren't. They had no idea that human life extended back that far. So whose history were they looking at when they concluded that man is flawed?
They were looking at their own history.
Exactly. They were looking at a half of 1% of the evidence taken from a single culture. Not a reasonable sample on which to base such a sweeping conclusion.
No.
There's nothing fundamentally wrong with people. Given a story to enact that puts them in accord with the world, they will live in accord with the world. But given a story to enact that puts them at odds with the world, as yours does, they will live at odds with the world. And given a story to enact in which the world is a foe to be conquered, they will conquer it like a foe. And one day, inevitably, their foe will lie bleeding to death at their feet, as the world is now. One major element of the story remains to be formulated before we go on, Ishmael continued. A striking feature of taker culture is its passionate and unwavering dependence on prophets. The influence of people like Moses, Gautama Buddha, Confucius, Jesus, and Mohammed in taker history is simply enormous. What makes them so important?
It's a good question, but I don't know the answer.
All right, try this. What were the prophets trying to accomplish here? What were they here to do?
Well, I'd say they were here to straighten us out and tell us how we ought to live.
Vital information worth dying for, evidently.
Evidently.
But why? Why do you need prophets to tell you how you ought to live? Why do you need anyone to tell you that?
We need prophets because otherwise we wouldn't know.
Why is that? Why wouldn't you know?
Well, I'd say it's because... Look at abortion. We can argue about it forever, but there's never going to be an argument powerful enough to end the argument, so it's impossible to know what to do. That's why we need the prophet. The prophet knows.
I agree, but the question remains, why don't you know?
I think the question remains because I can't answer it.
You know how to split atoms and how to send explorers to the moon, but you don't know how people ought to live. Why is that?
What does Mother Culture have to say about it?
Ah, I said, and after a minute or two, Mother Culture says it's possible to have certain knowledge about things like atoms and space travel, but there's no such knowledge about how people should live. It's just not available.
And having listened to Mother Culture, what do you say?
In this case, I have to agree. Certain knowledge about how to live is just not out there. The only way to settle anything is by taking a vote, which can change any time. Today the votes say abortion is okay, and tomorrow they may say it's a crime.
You're quite sure about all this. There is no way to obtain any certain knowledge about how people ought to live.
Absolutely sure.
Ishmael nodded. Tomorrow I'll challenge this certainty of yours.
Meanwhile, your culture's explanation of how things came to be this way is complete. The world was given to man to turn into a paradise, but he's always screwed it up because he's flawed. He doesn't know how to live and never will, because that knowledge is unobtainable. So however hard he labors to save the world, he's just going to go on screwing it up.
That's right. It's a sorry story you have there, a story of hopelessness and futility. A story in which there is literally nothing to be done. Here you are, rushing headlong toward catastrophe, and all you can do is watch it come.
Yes, that's the way it seems.
With only this wretched story to enact, it's no wonder you spend your lives stoned on booze or drugs or television. It's no wonder so many of you go mad or become suicidal.
True, but what other story is there to be in? There is another story to be in, but the Takers are doing their level best to destroy that, along with everything else. Yesterday, Ishmael said when we began the next morning, you told me that there is no way for people to study the universe so as to learn how to live.
That's right.
A century ago, the would-be aeronauts of the world were in much the same condition with regard to learning how to fly. It was far from certain that this knowledge existed at all. Some said it wasn't out there to be found, so it was useless to look for it. Do you see the similarity? At that point in time, there wasn't a single piece of knowledge about flying that was certain. All they could do was proceed by trial and error. What would have enabled them to proceed in a more efficient way? Well, as you say, obviously, some knowledge. But what knowledge in particular? Lord, they needed to know how to produce lift. They needed to know that air flowing over an airfoil...
What are you trying to describe?
I'm trying to describe what happens when air flows over an airfoil.
You mean what always happens? What's that called? A statement that describes what always happens when certain conditions are met.
A law.
Of course. The early aeronauts had to proceed by trial and error because they didn't know the laws of aerodynamics. Didn't even know there were laws.
Okay, I see what you're getting at now.
The people of your culture are in the same condition when it comes to learning how to live. They have to proceed by trial and error because they don't know the relevant laws, and don't even know that there are laws.
And I agree with them, I said.
You're certain no laws can be discovered concerning how people ought to live.
That's right. Obviously, there are made-up laws like laws against drug use, but these can be changed by a vote.
I understand. Mother culture teaches this, and you agree. That's fine. But now you see clearly what I'm reaching for, a law that you will agree is not subject to change by any vote. What's the law of gravity? Ishmael asked, once again startling me with an apparent change of subject.
The law of gravity? Well, the law of gravity is every particle in the universe is attracted to every other particle, and this attraction varies with the distance between them.
And that expression of the law was read where? Was derived by looking at what?
Well, at matter, I suppose.
And if you had the strange notion that there might be a set of laws about how to live, where would you look for it?
I don't know.
Would you look into the heavens, delve into the realm of subatomic particles?
No.
Take a wild guess.
Anthropology?
Anthropology is a field of study like physics. Did Newton discover the law of gravity by reading a book on physics? Is that where the law was written?
No.
Where was it written?
In matter, in the universe of matter.
So again, if there is a law pertaining to life, where will we find it written?
Well, I suppose in human behavior.
I have news for you. Man is not alone on this planet. He is part of a community upon which he depends absolutely.
True.
What's the name of this community of which man is only one member?
The community of life.
Bravo. Does it seem at all plausible to you that the law we're looking for could be written in this community?
I don't know.
What does Mother Culture say?
I closed my eyes and thought for a while.
Mother Culture says that if there were such a law, it wouldn't apply to us, because we're so far above the rest of that community.
I see.
And can you think of any other laws from which you are exempt? For example, cows and cockroaches are subject to the law of gravity. Are you exempt?
No.
What about the laws of aerodynamics, of genetics?
No.
Can you think of any laws from which you are exempt?
Not offhand.
Let me know if you do. That will be real news. But meanwhile, if there does happen to be a law for the community of life in general, humans would be exempt from it.
Well, that's what Mother Culture says.
And what do you say?
I don't know. I don't see how a law for turtles and butterflies could be of much relevance to us.
The laws of aerodynamics weren't always relevant to you, were they? When did they become relevant?
Well, when we wanted to fly.
And when you're on the brink of extinction and want to live for a while longer, the laws governing life might conceivably become relevant.
Yes, I suppose they might.
What's the effect of gravity?
Ishmael asked.
What's gravity good for? I say it's what organizes things on the macroscopic level. It's what keeps things together. The solar system, the galaxy, the universe.
Ishmael nodded. And the law we're looking for is the law that keeps the living community together. It organizes things on the biological level, just the way gravity organizes things on the macroscopic level.
Okay? Would you say that the law of gravity is about flight?
It isn't about flight, but it's certainly relevant in as much as it applies to aircraft the same way it applies to rocks. It makes no distinction between aircraft and rocks.
Yes, that's well said. The law we're looking for here is much like that with respect to civilizations. It's not about civilizations, but it applies to civilizations in the same way that it applies to flocks of birds and herds of deer. It makes no distinction between human civilizations and beehives. It applies to all species without distinction.
Ishmael went on. A man in a plane is subject to the law of gravity in exactly the way we're subject to it sitting here. But there's a big difference between us. The man in the plane obviously enjoys a freedom we lack, the freedom of the air.
True.
The law we're looking for is like that. There's no escaping it for anyone. But there is a way of achieving the equivalent of flight, the equivalent of freedom of the air. In other words, it is possible to build a civilization that flies.
I blinked at him.
Okay.
You remember how the Takers went about trying to achieve powered flight? They didn't begin with an understanding of the laws of aerodynamics. They just built contraptions, pushed them off the sides of cliffs, and hoped for the best.
Yes.
Let's follow one of those early trials in detail. As the flight begins, all is well. Our would-be airman, piloting one of those wonderful contraptions with flapping wings, has been pushed off the edge of the cliff and is pedaling away. He's ecstatic, experiencing the freedom of the air. What he doesn't realize, however, is that his craft is aerodynamically incapable of flight. It simply isn't in compliance with the laws that make flight possible. So he's an unsupported object falling toward the center of the Earth. From his great height, he can see for miles around, and one thing he sees puzzles him. The valley floor is dotted with craft just like his. Not crashed, simply abandoned. Why, he wonders, are these craft on the ground instead of in the air? What sort of fools abandon their aircraft when they could be enjoying the freedom of the air? Ah, well, the quirks of foolish mortals don't concern him. However, looking down into the valley has brought something else to his attention. He doesn't seem to be maintaining his altitude. In fact, the earth seems to be rising up toward him. Well, he's not worried about that. After all, his flight has been a complete success up to now, and there's no reason why it shouldn't go on being a success. He just has to pedal a little harder, that's all. So far, so good. He thinks with amusement of those who predicted that his flight would end in disaster, broken bones, and death. Here he is, he's come all this way, and he hasn't even gotten a bruise, much less a broken bone. But then he looks down again, and what he sees disturbs him. The law of gravity is catching up to him at an alarming rate. He's disturbed, but far from desperate. My craft has brought me this far in safety, he says, so he starts pedaling with all his might. Which does no good at all. Even with the power of a million men in his legs, that craft can't achieve flight. That craft is doomed. And so is he, unless he abandons it.
Right, I said. I see what you're saying, but I don't see the connection with what we're talking about here.
Ishmael nodded.
Here's the connection. 10,000 years ago, the people of your culture embarked on a similar flight, a civilizational flight. Their craft wasn't designed according to any theory at all. Like our airman, they were unaware that there is a law that must be complied with in order to achieve civilizational flight. They didn't even wonder about it. They wanted the freedom of the air, so they pushed off in the first contraption they saw, the Taker Thunderbolt. At first, all was well. In fact, all was terrific. The Takers were pedaling away, and the wings of their craft were flapping beautifully. They felt wonderful, exhilarated. They were experiencing the freedom of the air, freedom from restraints that bind and limit the rest of the biological community. And with that freedom came marvels. All the things you mentioned the other day, urbanization, technology, literacy, mathematics, science.
Their flight could never end. It could only go on, becoming more and more exciting. They couldn't know, couldn't guess, that like our hapless airmen, they were in the air, but not in flight. They were in free fall, because their craft was simply not in compliance with the law that makes flight possible. But their disillusionment is far in the future, so they pedal away and have a wonderful time. Like our airmen, they see strange sights. They see the remains of craft very like their own, not destroyed, merely abandoned on the ground, by the Maya, by the Hohokam, by the Anasazi, by the peoples of the Hopewell cult, to mention only a few of those found here in the New World. Why, they wonder, are these craft on the ground instead of in the air? Why would any people prefer to be earthbound when they could have the freedom of the air as we do? It's beyond comprehension, an unfathomable mystery. Ah, well, the vagaries of fools are nothing to the takers. They're peddling away and having a wonderful time. But alas, a law is catching up to them. They don't even know such a law exists, but that's no protection. This law is as unforgiving as the law of gravity, and it's catching up to them just the way that law caught up to our airmen, at an accelerating rate. Famine soon becomes a routine condition of life in many parts of the Taker Thunderbolt, and the Takers have to pedal even harder than before. But oddly enough, the harder they pedal, the worse conditions become. Very strange. Never mind, the Takers say. We'll just have to put some people pedaling away on a reliable method of birth control. Then the Taker Thunderbolt will fly forever. But such simple answers aren't enough to reassure the people of your culture nowadays. Everyone is looking down, and it's clear that the ground is rushing up toward you, and rushing up faster every year. Basic ecological systems are being impacted by the Taker Thunderbolt, and that impact increases in intensity every year. Pessimists, or maybe they're realists, look down and say, well, the crash may be 20 years off, or maybe as much as 50 years off. Actually, it could happen any time. But of course there are optimists as well who say, we must have faith in our craft. After all, it's brought us this far in safety. What's ahead isn't doom, it's just a little hump we can clear, if we pedal harder. But your craft isn't going to save you. On the contrary, it's your craft that's carrying you toward catastrophe. 5 billion of you pedaling away, or 20 billion, can't make it fly. It's been in free fall from the start. And that fall is about to end. And the worst part is, I added, that the survivors will want to do it all over again, exactly the same way. Yes, I'm afraid you're right. Here's a puzzle to consider, said Ishmael. Traveling in a far land, you find yourself in a strange city, isolated from all others. You're impressed by the natives. They're friendly, healthy, and peaceable. And they say they've always been so. Well, you're glad to break your journey here, and one family invites you to stay with them. That night you sample their food, and finding it delicious but unfamiliar, ask them what it is. And they say, oh, it's bee meat, of course, that's all we eat. This naturally puzzles you, and you ask if they mean the meat of the little insects that gather honey. They laugh, and take you to the window. There are some bees there, they say, pointing to their neighbors in the next house. Good Lord, you exclaim. You don't mean you eat people? And they look at you in a puzzled way and say, we eat bees. How atrocious, you reply. Do you keep them penned up? Why on earth would we do that, your host asks. To keep them from running away, of course. Puzzled, they explain that the bees would never run away because their own food, the A's, live just across the street. Well, I won't weary you with all your outraged exclamations and their baffled explanations. Eventually you understand the whole ghastly scheme. A's are eaten by B's, and B's are eaten by C's, and C's, in turn, are eaten by A's. It's all perfectly democratic and friendly, but of course it's perfectly dreadful to you, and you ask how they can stand to live in this lawless way. What do you mean, lawless? They ask. We have a law, which is the foundation of our success, and we follow it invariably. Here at last is the puzzle. Without asking them, how can you discover what their law is? Well, obviously their law is that A's eat C's, and B's eat A's, and C's eat B's. These are food preferences. No law is required.
I need something more to go on, then.
You have three other things to go on. They have a law, follow it invariably, and have a highly successful society.
Well, I suppose it's something like, be cool.
I'm not asking you to guess what the law is, Ishmael said. I'm asking you to devise a method for discovering what the law is.
I slid down in my chair and stared at the ceiling, and at last I said,
observation, careful observation over a long period.
That's more like it. What would you be looking for?
For what they didn't do, for what they never did.
Good. But how would you eliminate irrelevancies? For example, they may never throw rocks at the moon, but this wouldn't necessarily be prohibited.
True. Well, let's see. According to them, following this law has given them a society that works very well. This would eliminate irrelevancies. The fact that they never throw rocks at the moon wouldn't give them a society that works well. Let's see. I'd be closing in on it from two sides. From one side, I'd be saying, what is it that makes this society work? And from the other side, I'd be saying, what is it they don't do that makes this society work?
Bravo. Now, since you've worked this out so brilliantly, I'm going to give you a break. For the first time in history, someone has broken the law. This should be a big help to you.
What did this person do?
I'm not going to tell you that. He did things the others never do. Study his life, and you'll see what they are.
I said, okay, I can see that this gives me another guide. I now have three. One, what makes their society work well? Two, what they never do. And three, what he did that they never do.
Very good, said Ishmael. These are precisely the three guides you have to the law we're looking for here. The community of life on this planet has worked beautifully for 3 billion years. The Takers draw back in horror from this community, thinking it to be a place of lawless chaos where every creature goes in terror of its life. But those of your species who actually live in this community don't find it to be so. And they'll fight to the death rather than be separated from it. It is, in fact, an orderly community. The green plants are food for the plant eaters, which are food for the predators, and some of these predators are food for still other predators, and what's left over is food for the scavengers, who return to the earth nutrients needed by the green plants. It's a system that has worked magnificently for billions of years. Filmmakers love footage of gore and battle, but any naturalist will tell you that the species are not at war with one another. The lion that comes across a herd of gazelles doesn't massacre them as an enemy would. It kills one, not to satisfy its hatred, but to satisfy its hunger. And once it has made its kill, the gazelles will go on grazing with the lion right in their midst. All this comes about because there is a law that is followed invariably within the community, and without this law, the community would indeed be in chaos, and would quickly disintegrate and disappear. Man owes his very existence to this law. If the species around him had not obeyed it, he could not have come into being or survived. It's the peacekeeping law, a law that protects not only the community as a whole, but species within the community, and even individuals. Do you understand?
I understand, but I have no idea what the law is.
I'm pointing to its effects.
Oh, okay.
At the time when the Takers blundered into the new world and began kicking everything to pieces, the Leavers here were searching for an answer to this question. Is there a way to achieve settlement that is in accord with the law that we've been following from the beginning of time? I don't mean, of course, that they had consciously formulated this question. They were no more consciously aware of this law than the early aeronauts were consciously aware of the laws of aerodynamics. But they were struggling with it all the same, building and abandoning one civilizational contraption after another, trying to find one that would fly. Done this way, it's slow work. Proceeding simply by trial and error, it might have taken them another 10,000 years, or another 50,000. They apparently had the wisdom to know there was no hurry. They didn't have to get into the air. It made no sense to them to commit themselves to a civilizational craft that was clearly headed for disaster the way the Takers had done. Ishmael stopped there, and when he didn't go on, I said, "What now?" His cheeks crinkled in a smile.
Now you leave and come back when you're prepared to tell me what law or set of laws has been at work in the community of life from the beginning. You have the same three guides as in the case of the A's, the B's, and the C's. The law you're looking for has been obeyed invariably in the living community for 3 billion years. He nodded to the world outside. And this is how things came to be this way. If this law had not been obeyed from the beginning, and in each generation thereafter, the seas would be lifeless deserts, and the land would still be dust blowing in the wind. All the countless forms of life that you see here came into being following this law, and following this law, man too came into being. And only once in all the history of this planet has any species tried to live in defiance of this law. And it wasn't an entire species, it was only one people, those I've named Takers. 10,000 years ago, this one people said no more, man was not meant to be bound by this law. And they began to live in a way that flouts the law at every point. Every single thing that is prohibited under the law, they incorporated into their civilization as a fundamental policy. And now, after 500 generations, they are about to pay the penalty that any other species would pay for living contrary to this law.
Ishmael turned over a hand. That should be guide enough for you.
The search for the law took me 4 days. I spent one day telling myself I couldn't do it, two doing it, and one making sure I'd done it. On the fifth day, I went back. I think I see why you insisted I do it myself, I told Ishmael. If you'd done the work for me and pointed out the things the Takers do that are never done in the natural community, I would have said, well, sure, so what? Big deal.
Ishmael grunted and told me to carry on.
Okay. As I make it out, there are 4 things the Takers do that are never done in the rest of the community, and these are all fundamental to their civilizational system. First, they exterminate their competitors, which is something that never happens in the wild. In the wild, animals will defend their territories and their kills, and they will invade their competitors' territories and preempt their kills. Some even include competitors among their prey, but they never hunt them down just to make them dead, the way ranchers and farmers do with coyotes and foxes and crows. What they hunt, they eat.
Go on.
Next, the Takers systematically destroy their competitors' food to make room for their own. Nothing like this occurs in the natural community. The rule there is take what you need and leave the rest alone.
Ishmael nodded.
Next, the Takers deny their competitors access to food. In the wild, the rule is you may deny your competitors access to what you're eating, but you may not deny them access to food in general. In other words, you can say, this gazelle is mine, but you can't say all gazelles are mine. Our policy is every square foot of this planet belongs to us. So if we put it all under cultivation, then all our competitors are just plain out of luck and will have to become extinct.
Good. And you say there's a 4th thing the Takers do that is never done in the wild, as you call it.
Yes, in the wild, the lion kills a gazelle and eats it. It doesn't kill a second to save for tomorrow. The deer eats the grass that's there. It doesn't cut the grass down and save it for the winter. But these are things the Takers do.
You seem less certain about this one.
Yes, I am less certain. There are species that store food, like bees, but most don't.
In this case, you've missed the obvious. Every living creature stores food, most simply store it in their bodies, the way lions and deer and people do. For others, this would be inadequate to their adaptations, and they must store food externally as well.
I see.
There's no prohibition against food storage as such. There couldn't be, because that's what makes the whole system work. The green plants store food for the plant eaters store food for the predators, and so on.
Oh, true, I hadn't thought of it that way.
Is there anything else the Takers do that is never done in the rest of the community of life?
Not that I can see, not that seems relevant to what makes that community work.
This law, Ishmael said,
defines the limit of competition in the community of life. You may compete to the full extent of your capabilities, but you may not hunt down your competitors, or destroy their food, or deny them access to food. In other words, you may compete, but you may not wage war.
Yes, as you said, it's the peacekeeping law.
And what's the effect of the law? What does it promote?
Well, it promotes order.
Yes, but I'm after something else now. What would have happened if this law had been repealed 10 million years ago? What would the community be like?
I'd have to say that there would only be one form of life at each level of competition, the strongest.
So the law promotes what?
Well, it promotes diversity.
Of course. And what's the good of diversity? What's wrong with a global community that consists of nothing but grass, gazelles, and lions, or a global community that consists of nothing but rice and humans?
I'd have to think that a community like that would be ecologically fragile, highly vulnerable. Any change at all in existing conditions and the whole thing would collapse.
Ishmael nodded. Diversity is a survival factor for the community itself. A community of 100 million species can survive almost anything short of total global catastrophe, while a community of 100 species or 1,000 species has almost no survival value at all.
True, I said. And diversity is exactly what's under attack here. Every day, dozens of species disappear as a direct result of the way the takers compete outside the law.
Now that you know there's a law involved, does it make a difference in the way you view what's going on?
Yes, I no longer think of what we're doing as a blunder. We're not destroying the world because we're clumsy. We're destroying the world because we are, in a very literal and deliberate way, at war with it.
Ishmael sighed. As you've explained, the community would be destroyed if all species exempted themselves from the rules of competition. But what would happen if only one species exempted itself?
You mean other than man?
Yes. Suppose you're a hyena. Why share the game with those lazy lions? It happens again and again. You kill a zebra, and a lion comes along, drives you off, and helps himself while you sit around waiting for the leavings. So you're fed up with them. What are you going to do about it?
Exterminate the lions.
And what's the effect of this?
Well, there's more game for us.
And when there's more game for you?
I looked at him blankly.
All right, I was assuming you knew the ABCs of ecology. In the natural community, whenever a population's food supply increases, that population increases. As that population increases, its food supply decreases. And as its food supply decreases, that population decreases. This interaction between food and feeders is what keeps everything in balance.
Right, I did know it. So, with lions gone, there's more food for hyenas, and our population grows. It grows to the point where game becomes scarce, and then it begins to shrink.
It would in ordinary circumstances, but you've changed those circumstances. You've decided the law of limited competition doesn't apply to hyenas.
True. So we kill our other competitors. And after that, once again, our population grows until the game gets scarce. Let's see, there are no more competitors to kill off, so we have to increase the game population. How do we do that?
Your game has competitors as well. Kill off these competitors, and there will be more grass for your game.
Right, more grass for the game means more game. More game means more hyenas. More hyenas means... Well, what's left to kill? Let's see. We've killed off our competitors, and our competitors once removed. Now we can kill off our competitors twice removed. Plants that compete with the grass for space and sunlight.
That's right. Then there will be more plants for your game and more game for you.
It's funny, this is considered almost holy work by farmers and ranchers. Kill off everything you can't eat. Kill off anything that eats what you eat. Kill off anything that doesn't feed what you eat.
It is holy work in taker culture, Ishmael said. The more competitors you destroy, the more humans you can bring into the world, and that makes it just about the holiest work there is. Once you exempt yourself from this law, everything in the world except your food and the food of your food becomes an enemy to be exterminated.
So what have we discovered here? We've discovered that any species that exempts itself from the rules of competition ends up destroying the community in order to support its own expansion.
Any species, including man?
Yes, obviously. That's in fact what's happening here.
So you see that this is not some mysterious wickedness peculiar to the human race. It isn't some imponderable flaw in man that has made you the destroyers of the world. No, the same would happen with any species, provided every increase in food supply produces an increase in population.
Given an expanding food supply, said Ishmael, any population will expand. This is true of any species, including the human. The takers have been proving this here for 10,000 years. For 10,000 years, they've been steadily increasing food production to feed an increased population. And every time they've done this, the population has increased still more. A week ago, when we were talking about laws, you said there's only one kind about how people should live, the kind that can be changed by a vote. What do you think now? Can the law of limited competition be changed by a vote?
No.
Are you certain that any species that exempts itself from this law will end by destroying the community to support its own expansion?
Yes.
Then what have we discovered here?
We've discovered a piece of certain knowledge about how people ought to live, must live.
Knowledge that a week ago you said was unobtainable.
Yes, though I don't see how to make this a source of knowledge in general. I mean, I don't see any way to apply this knowledge to other issues.
Ishmael replied, "The law we've outlined here enables species to live, enables species to survive, including the human. It won't tell you whether premarital sex is good or bad. It won't tell you whether capital punishment is right or wrong. It will tell you how to live if you want to avoid extinction. And that's the first and most fundamental knowledge anyone needs."
True.
Before we go on, Ishmael said, I want to clear up a misconception. You know your culture was born in an agricultural revolution that began about 10,000 years ago.
That's right.
How long did the revolution last?
I said, I don't really know. It must have lasted a couple thousand years.
Think.
I thought, and after a while said, okay, it's strange that this isn't taught. It didn't end. It just spread. It's been spreading ever since it began, back there 10,000 years ago. It spread across this continent in the 18th and 19th centuries. It's still spreading across parts of New Zealand and Africa and South America today.
Of course, he said. So you see that your agricultural revolution is not an event like the Trojan War, isolated in the distant past and without direct relevance to your lives today. The work begun by those Neolithic farmers in the Near East has been carried forward from one generation to the next without a break, right into the present moment. It's the foundation of your vast civilization today in exactly the same way that it was the foundation of the very first farming village.
Yes, I see that. That's pretty amazing.
This is why the story you tell your children about the meaning of the world, about divine intentions in the world, and about the destiny of man is of such importance to you. It's the manifesto of the revolution on which your culture is based. It's the repository of all your revolutionary doctrine and the definitive expression of your revolutionary spirit. It explains why the revolution was necessary and why it must be carried forward at any cost whatever.
Yes, I said. That's quite a thought.
About 2,000 years ago, Ishmael went on, an event of exquisite irony occurred within your culture. The takers adopted as their own a lever story about their origins.
A lever story about the origin of the takers?
That's right.
Do I know this story?
Oh, yes. Every taker in the world knows it. I'll tell a story of my own, then you'll recognize it.
Okay.
There's a special knowledge you must have if you're going to rule the world, Ishmael said. I'm sure you realize that.
Frankly, I've never thought about it.
The takers possess this knowledge, of course. At least they imagine they do. And they're very, very proud of it. It's the most fundamental knowledge of all, and absolutely indispensable to those who would rule the world. And who else do you suppose would have this knowledge beside the takers?
I have no idea.
Think mythologically.
Okay, well, the gods would have it.
Of course. And that's what my story is about, how the gods acquired the knowledge they needed to rule the world. One day, Ishmael began,
The gods were considering the administration of the world, and one of them said, "Here's a spot I've been thinking about, a wide, pleasant savanna. Let's send a great multitude of locusts into this land. Then the fire of life will grow prodigiously in them, and in the birds and the lizards that will feed on them, and that will be very fine." The others thought about this for a while, and then one said, "It's certainly true that if we send the locusts into this land, the fire of life will blaze in them and in the creatures that feed on them, but at the expense of all others. Wouldn't it be a great crime to deprive all these other creatures of the fire of life so that the locusts and the birds and the lizards can flourish for a time? For the locusts will strip the land bare, and the deer and the gazelles and the goats and the rabbits will go hungry and die. And with the disappearance of the game, the lions and the wolves and the foxes will soon be dying too. Won't they curse us then and call us criminals for favoring the locusts and the birds and the lizards over them?" Now the gods had to scratch their heads over this, because they'd never looked at things this way before. But finally one said, "This is no problem. We just won't do it. We won't raise a multitude of locusts to send into this land, and then things will go on as before, and no one will have any reason to curse us." Most agreed, but one said, "Surely this would be as great a crime as the other. Don't the locusts and the birds and the lizards live in our hands as well as the rest? Is it never to be their time to flourish greatly, as others do?" While the gods were debating this, a fox came out to hunt, and they said, "Let's send the fox a quail for its life." But these words were hardly spoken when one said, "Surely it would be a crime to let the fox live at the quail's expense. The quail has its life that we gave it, and lives in our hands. It would be infamous to send it into the jaws of the fox." Then another said, "Look here, the quail is stalking a grasshopper. If we don't give the quail to the fox, the quail will eat the grasshopper. Doesn't the grasshopper have its life that we gave it, and doesn't it live in our hands as truly as the quail? Surely it would be a crime not to give the quail to the fox so that the grasshopper may live." Well, as you can imagine, the gods groaned heavily over this and didn't know what to do. Meanwhile, spring came, and the snow waters of the mountains began to swell the streams, and one of them said, "Surely it would be a crime to let these waters flood the land, for countless creatures will drown." But another said, "Surely it would be a crime not to let these waters flood the land, for without them the ponds and marshes will dry up, and everything that lives in them will die." And once more the gods were thrown into confusion. Finally one of them had a new thought. "Clearly, any action we take will be good for some and evil for others. So let's take no action at all. Then no one can call us criminals." "Nonsense," another snapped. "If we take no action at all, this will also be good for some and evil for others, won't it? The creatures that live in our hands will say, 'Look, we suffer and the gods do nothing.'" And while the gods bickered among themselves, the locusts swarmed over the savanna, and the locusts and the birds and the lizards praised the gods, while the game and the predators died cursing the gods. And because the gods had taken no action, the quail lived, and the fox went hungry to its hole, cursing the gods. And because the quail lived, it ate the grasshopper, and the grasshopper died cursing the gods. And because in the end the gods decided to stem the flood of spring waters, the ponds and the marshes dried up, and all that lived in them died cursing the gods. And hearing these curses, the gods groan. "We have made the garden a place of terror, and our creatures hate us. And they're right to do this, because by action or inaction, we send them good one day and evil the next, without knowing what we should do." Well, the gods were near despair when one looked up and said, "Say, didn't we make for the garden a certain tree whose fruit is the knowledge of good and evil?" "Yes," cried the others, "let's find that tree, and eat of it, and see what this knowledge is." And when the gods had found this tree and had tasted its fruit, their eyes were opened, and they said, "Now indeed we have the knowledge we need to tend the garden without becoming criminals and without earning the curses of all who live in our hands." And as they were talking, a lion went out to hunt, and the gods said, "Today is the lion's day to go hungry, and the deer may live another day." So the lion missed its kill and began to curse the gods, but they said, "Be at peace, for we know how to rule the world, and today is your day to go hungry." And the lion was at peace.
And the next day the lion went out to hunt, and the god sent it the deer they had spared the day before. And as the deer felt the lion's jaws on its neck, it began to curse the gods. But they said, "Be at peace, for we know how to rule the world, and today is your day to die, just as yesterday was your day to live." And the deer was at peace. Then the gods said to themselves, "Certainly the knowledge of good and evil is a powerful knowledge, for it enables us to rule the world without becoming criminals. If we had yesterday sent the lion away hungry without this knowledge, then indeed it would have been a crime. And if we had today sent the deer into the lion's jaws without this knowledge, then this too would have been a crime. But with this knowledge we have done both of these things, one seemingly opposed to the other, and have committed no crime." Now it happened that one of the gods was away during these events. And when he returned and heard what the others had done, he said, "What knowledge does this tree provide?" "Taste its fruit," they told him. "Then you'll know exactly what knowledge it is." So the god tasted it, and his eyes were opened. "Yes, I see," he said. "This is indeed the proper knowledge of the gods, the knowledge of who shall live and who shall die." "Any questions so far?" Ishmael asked. I jumped, startled by this break in the narrative. "No, this is fascinating," Ishmael went on. When the gods saw that Adam was awakening, they said to themselves, "Now here's a creature so like us that he might almost be one of our company. What span of life and what destiny shall we fashion for him?" One of them said, "Let's give him life for the lifetime of this planet. In the days of his childhood, let's care for him as we care for all others in the garden, so that he learns the sweetness of living in our hands. But in adolescence, he'll soon realize that he's capable of much more than other creatures, and will become restless in our care. Shall we then lead him to the other tree in the garden, the tree of life?" Another said, "To lead Adam like a child to this tree would deprive him of a great undertaking. As we'd give him the care he needs as a child, let's give him the quest he needs as an adolescent. In the quest for the tree of life, he'll discover for himself how to have life for the lifetime of this planet." The others agreed, but one said, "This might well be a long and baffling quest for Adam. Youth is impatient, and after a few thousand years of searching, he might despair of finding the tree of life. If this should happen, he might be tempted to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil instead." "Nonsense," the others replied. "You know that the fruit of this tree nourishes only us. It can no more nourish Adam than the grasses of the oxen. Surely you don't imagine that he might actually gain our knowledge by eating of this tree." "Of course not," the other replied. "The danger is not that he would gain our knowledge, but that he might imagine he'd gained it. Having tasted the fruit of this tree, he might say to himself, 'I've eaten at the God's own tree of knowledge, and therefore know as well as they how to rule the world.'" The other god shrugged. "Perhaps in childhood Adam might believe he was wise enough to rule the world, but what of it? Such arrogant foolishness would pass with maturity." "Ah," said the other, "but possessed of this arrogant foolishness, would Adam survive into maturity? In his arrogance he might look around the garden and say to himself, 'This is all wrong. Why should I share the fire of life with all these creatures? Look here, the lions and the wolves and the foxes take the game I would have for myself. This is evil. I will kill all these creatures, and this will be good. And look here, the rabbits and the grasshoppers and the sparrows take the fruits of the land that I would have for myself. This is evil. I'll kill all these creatures, and this will be good. And look here, the gods have set a limit on my growth, just as they've set a limit on the growth of all others. This is evil. I will grow without limit, taking all the fire of life that flows through this garden into myself, and that will be good. Tell me, if this should happen, how long would Adam live before he had devoured the entire world?" "If this should happen," the others said, "Adam would devour the world in a single day, and at the end of that day he would devour himself." And the gods saw that of all the trees in the garden, only the tree of the knowledge of good and evil could destroy Adam. And so they said to him, "You may eat of every tree in the garden, save the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For on the day you eat of that tree, you will certainly die." Thank you.
I sat there dazed for a while. Then I recalled seeing a Bible in Ishmael's collection of books. In fact, there were three. I fetched them, and after a few minutes of study, looked up and said, "None of these has any comment to make on why this tree was forbidden to Adam."
"Were you expecting them to?"
"Well, yes."
"The takers write the notes, and this story has always been an impenetrable mystery to them. They've never been able to figure out why the knowledge of good and evil should have been forbidden to man. To the takers, this knowledge is the very best knowledge of all, the most beneficial for man to have. This being so, why would the gods forbid it to him?"
"True.
The knowledge of good and evil is fundamentally the knowledge the rulers of the world must exercise, because every single thing they do is good for some, but evil for others. This is what ruling is all about, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"And man was born to rule the world, wasn't he?"
"Yes, according to Taker mythology."
"Then why would the gods withhold the very knowledge man needs to fulfill his destiny? From the Taker point of view, it makes no sense at all."
"True.
The gods ruled the world for billions of years, and it was doing just fine. But now, after just a few thousand years of human rule, the world is at the point of death."
"True, but the takers will never give it up."
Ishmael shrugged. "Then they'll die, as predicted. The authors of this story knew what they were talking about."
I asked, "And you're saying this story was written from a lever point of view?"
"That's right. If it had been written from the Taker point of view, the knowledge of good and evil wouldn't have been forbidden to Adam. It would have been thrust upon him. The gods would have hung around saying, 'Come on, man! Can't you see that you're nothing without this knowledge? Stop living off our bounty like a lion or a wombat. Here, have some of this fruit, and you'll instantly realize that you're naked as any lion or wombat, naked to the world, powerless. Come on, have some of this fruit and become one of us. Then, lucky you can leave this garden and begin living by the sweat of your brow, the way humans are supposed to live.'" Ishmael gazed at me. "And if people of your cultural persuasion had authored it, this event wouldn't be called the fall. It would be called the ascent. Or, as you put it earlier, the liberation."
"Very true, but I'm not quite sure how this fits in with everything else."
"We're furthering your understanding of how things came to be this way."
"I don't get it."
"You say the takers will never give up their tyranny over the world, no matter how bad things get. How did they get to be this way? They got to be this way because they've always believed that what they were doing was right, and therefore to be done at any cost, whatever. They've always believed that, like the gods, they know what's right to do and what's wrong to do. And what they're doing is right. They've demonstrated this by forcing everyone in the world to do what they do, to live the way they live. Everyone had to be forced to live like the takers, because the takers had the one right way."
"Yes, I can certainly see that.
Many peoples among the levers practiced agriculture, but they never had the delusion that what they were doing was right, that everyone in the world had to practice agriculture, that every last square yard of the planet had to be devoted to it. They didn't say to the people around them, 'You may no longer live by hunting and gathering. This is wrong, and we forbid it. Put your land under cultivation, or we'll kill you.' What they said was, 'You want to be hunter-gatherers? That's fine with us. We want to be agriculturalists. You be hunter-gatherers, and we'll be agriculturalists. We don't pretend to know which way is right. We just know which way we prefer.'"
"Yes, I see."
"And if they got tired of being agriculturalists, if they found they didn't like where it was leading them, they were able to give it up. They didn't say, 'We've got to stick to this, even if it kills us, because this is the right way to live.' For example, there was once a people who constructed a vast network of irrigation canals to farm the deserts of southeastern Arizona. They maintained these canals for 3,000 years, but in the end they were free to say, 'This is a toilsome and unsatisfying way to live, so to hell with it.' They walked away from their whole civilization and put it so totally out of mind that we don't even know what they called themselves. The only name we have for them is the one the Pima Indians gave them, Hohokam, those who vanished. But it's not going to be this easy for the takers. It's going to be hard as hell for them to give it up, because what they're doing is right, and they have to go on doing it, even if it means destroying the world and mankind with it."
"Yes, that's the way it seems."
"Giving it up would mean what?"
"Giving it up would mean It would mean that all along they've been wrong. It would mean that they'd never known how to rule the world. It would mean relinquishing their pretensions to godhood. It would mean spitting out the fruit of that tree and giving the rule of the world back to the gods. Yes. Ishmael nodded to the stack of Bibles at my feet. Who were the authors of this story? Well, the Hebrews.
Ishmael shook his head. Among the people known as the Hebrews, this was already an ancient story and a mysterious story. The Hebrews stepped into history as takers, wanted nothing more than to be like their taker neighbors. Indeed, that's why their prophets were always bawling them out.
True.
So, though they preserved the story, they no longer fully understood it. To find the people who understood it, we have to find its authors. And who were they?
Well, they were the ancestors of the Hebrews.
But who were they?
I'm afraid I have no idea.
The ancestors of the Hebrews were the Semites.
Oh, right.
Among my books, Ishmael said, you'll find an historical atlas. Please get it and turn to the map for 8500 BC.
I did so, and found I was looking at a map of Europe and the Middle East. A curved blade nearly cut the Arabian Peninsula away from the rest. The words incipient agriculture indicated that this blade enclosed the Fertile Crescent.
You see where your agricultural revolution began, Ishmael said, in the land between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. You should note that at this point, these early takers, the founders of your culture, were unknown, isolated, unimportant. The next map in that historical atlas is 4,000 years later. What would you expect to see on it?
I'd expect to see that the takers have expanded.
He nodded, and I turned the page. Here a printed oval labeled Chalcolithic cultures, with Mesopotamia at its center, enclosed the whole of Asia Minor and all the land to the north and east as far as the Caspian Sea and the Persian Gulf. The oval extended southward as far as the entrance to the Arabian Peninsula, which was a cross-hatched area labeled Semites. As you can see from this map, the Semites were not the people of the Fall. The people of the Fall lived hundreds of miles to the north of the Semites. Do you see who they were?
According to the map, they were the Caucasians.
Now, in 4500 BC, the Semites are encountering the people of the Fall in their own front yard. They're confronting the expansion of the takers.
Yes, I see.
In 4,000 years, the agricultural revolution that began in the land between the rivers had spread across Asia Minor to the west and to the mountains in the north and the east. And to the south, it seemed to have been blocked by what?
By the Semites, apparently.
Why? Why were the Semites blocking it?
I don't know.
What were the Semites? Were they agriculturalists?
No, I said, the map makes it clear that they weren't a part of that revolution, so I assume they were leavers.
Leavers, yes, but no longer hunter-gatherers. They had evolved another adaptation that was to be traditional for Semitic peoples.
Oh, they were pastoralists.
Of course, herders.
He indicated the border between the Takers' Chalcolithic culture and the Semites.
So, what was happening here?
I don't know.
Ishmael nodded toward the Bibles at my feet. Read the story of Cain and Abel in Genesis, then you'll know.
I picked up the one on top and turned to chapter 4. A couple of minutes later, I muttered, "Good Lord."
After reading the story in all three versions, I looked up and said, what was happening along that border was that Cain was killing Abel. The tillers of the soil were watering their fields with the blood of Semitic herders.
Of course. What was happening there was what has always happened along the borders of taker expansion. The leavers were being slaughtered so that more land could be put under cultivation. At the border that separates tillers of the soil from Semitic herders, Cain and Abel confront each other.
I studied the map for a few moments and then shook my head.
And biblical scholars don't understand this?
Biblical scholars read this story as if it were set in an historical never-never land like one of Aesop's fables. It wouldn't occur to them to understand it as a piece of Semitic war propaganda.
That's what it is, all right. So it's been a mystery as to why God accepted Abel's offering and rejected Cain's. You've explained it.
With this story, the Semites were telling their children, God is for us. He loves us herders, but hates those murderous tillers of the soil from the north.
That's right. If you read it as a story that originated among your own cultural ancestors, it's incomprehensible. It only begins to make sense when you realize that it originated among the enemies of your cultural ancestors.
Yes.
I sat there blinking for a few moments, then looked at Ishmael's map again. If the tillers of the soil from the north were Caucasians, I said, then the mark of Cain is this. I pointed to my own fair or maggot-colored face.
It could be. Obviously, we'll never know for sure what the authors of the story had in mind.
But it makes sense this way, I insisted. Cain was given the mark as a warning to others. Leave this man alone. This is a dangerous man, one who exacts a sevenfold vengeance. Certainly a lot of people all over the world have learned that it doesn't pay to mess with people with white faces.
Ishmael shrugged, unconvinced, or perhaps just uninterested.
The next day, an uncle of mine arrived unannounced and expected to be entertained. I thought it would be a day, but it turned out to be three. Just before I took him to the airport, I received an ultimatum from a client. No more excuses, do the work now or send back the advance. I said I'd do the work now. I took my uncle to the airport, came back, and sat down at the word processor. It wasn't that big a chore, I told myself. Pointless to make a trip downtown just to tell Ishmael I wouldn't be there for another day or two. But in the water of my bones and bowels, there was a tremor of apprehension. One more day, I said to myself. I'll get this in the mail tonight, and one more day won't matter. The gambler who puts his last 100 on odd and watches the ball hop into slot 18 will tell you he knew it was a losing bet the instant the chip left his hand. But, of course, if it had taken one more hop and landed in 19, he would cheerfully admit that such presentiments were often wrong. Mine was not. From the head of the hallway, I saw an industrial-sized floor scrubber parked outside Ishmael's door. Before I could get there, a middle-aged man in a gray uniform backed out and started locking up. I called to him to wait. "What are you doing?" I asked when he was in range of a normal tone of voice. It didn't really deserve an answer. He didn't give me one. "Look," I said, "I know it's none of my business, but would you mind telling me what's going on here?" He looked at me as if I were a roach he'd killed a week ago. Nonetheless, he finally worked his mouth and let a few words through. "Getting the place ready for a new tenant." "Ah," I said, "but what happened to the old tenant?" He shrugged indifferently. "Got evicted, I guess. Wasn't paying her rent." "Her rent?" I had momentarily forgotten that Ishmael was not his own caretaker. He gave me a doubtful look. "I thought you knew the lady." "No, I knew He stood there, blinking at me. "Look," I said, again floundering, "there's probably a note in there for me or something. Ain't nothing at all in there now, except a bad smell." "Would you mind if I had a look for myself?" He turned back to the door and locked it.
"You talk to the management about it, okay? I got things to do."
Talking to the management proved to be like talking to a head on Mount Rushmore. What management knew, it wasn't telling. There were a dozen Sokolovs in the phone book, but none was named Rachel. There was a Grace, with the right sort of address for the widow of a wealthy Jewish merchant. The next morning, early, I took my car and did a little discreet trespassing to see if the grounds sported a gazebo. They did. The Beaux-Arts style isn't to everyone's taste, but I happen to like it when it doesn't confuse itself with a wedding cake. The Sokolov mansion looked cool and majestic, yet ever so slightly whimsical, like royalty on a picnic. After ringing the bell, I had lots of time to study the front door, a work of art in its own right. After a while, it was opened by a man I'd endorse for Secretary of State on looks alone. He didn't have to say yeah or well. He asked my business just by twitching an eyebrow. I told him I wanted to see Mrs. Sokolov. He asked me if I had an appointment, knowing full well I didn't. I decided to open up a little. "The truth is, I'm trying to get in touch with her daughter."
He gave me a leisurely going over with his eyes. "You're not a friend of hers," he said at last.
No, frankly, I'm not.
"If you were, you'd know she died 3 months ago." His words went through me like a dose of ice water. He twitched another eyebrow, meaning, "Anything else?"
I decided to open up a little more. "Were you with Mr. Sokolov?"
He frowned, letting me know that he doubted the relevance of my inquiry.
The reason I ask is, may I ask your name?
He doubted the relevance of this inquiry as well, but he decided to humor me. My name is Partridge.
Well, Mr. Partridge, the reason I ask is, did you know Ishmael?
He narrowed his eyes at me.
To be completely honest, I'm not looking for Rachel. I'm looking for Ishmael. I understand she took charge of him when her father died.
How do you come to understand that? He asked, giving away nothing.
Mr. Partridge, if you know the answer to that, you'll probably help me, I said. And if you don't know the answer, you probably won't.
It was an elegant point, and he awarded it a nod. Then he asked why I was looking for Ishmael.
He's missing from his usual place. He was evicted.
Someone must have moved him, helped him.
Yes, I said. I don't suppose he walked into Hertz and rented a car.
Partridge ignored my witticism. I honestly don't know anything, I'm afraid.
Mrs. Sokolov?
If she knew anything, I'd know it first. I believed him, but said, give me a place to start.
I don't know of any place to start now that Miss Sokolov is dead.
I chewed on that for a while. What'd she die of?
You didn't know her at all?
Not from Adam.
Then that's really none of your business, he told me, without rancor, just stating a plain fact.
I considered hiring a private investigator. Then I rehearsed in my head the conversation it would take to get started and decided to skip it. One thing was obvious. Ishmael had some friends I didn't know about. Perhaps former pupils. The only way I could reach them was the way he'd probably reach them, through an ad in the personals. Friends of Ishmael, another friend has lost contact. Please call and tell me where he is. The ad was a mistake because it gave me an excuse to turn my brain off. I waited for it to appear, then I waited for it to run for a week, and then I waited a few more days for a call that didn't come. And in that way, 2 weeks passed, during which I didn't lift a finger. When I finally faced the fact that I wasn't going to get a response, I had to find a new heading, and it took me about 3 minutes to come up with it. I called City Hall and was soon talking to the person who would issue a permit to a traveling show if one turned up and wanted to squat on a vacant lot for a week. Was there one in town at the moment? No. Had there been any in the past month?
Yes. The Darrell Hicks Carnival, with 19 rides, 24 games, and a sideshow, had been and was gone now for a couple of weeks.
Anything like a menagerie? Maybe an animal or two in the sideshow?
Dunno. Possible.
Next stop on its route?
No idea at all.
It didn't matter. A dozen calls tracked it to a town 40 miles north where it had stayed a week. Assuming it would keep moving north, I located its next stop and present location with a single call. And yes, it now boasted of having Gargantua, the world's most famous gorilla. A critter that I personally knew had been dead for something like 40 years. For you, or anyone with a reasonably modern vehicle, the Darrell Hicks Carnival would have been 90 minutes away. But for me, in a Plymouth that came out the same year as Dallas, it was 2 hours. When I found it, the carnival proved to be 2 acres of the usual sleaze, masquerading as merriment, full of ugly people, noise, and the stink of beer, cotton candy, and popcorn. I waded through it in search of the sideshow. I have the impression that sideshows are nearly extinct in the modern carnival world. If so, the Darrell Hicks has elected to ignore the trend. When I arrived, a barker was putting a fire-eater through his paces, but I didn't stay to watch. There was plenty to see inside, the usual collection of monsters, freaks, and geeks, a bottle-biter, a pincushion, a tattooed fat lady, all the rest, which I ignored. Ishmael was in a dim corner as far away as possible, with 2 10-year-olds in attendance. I stood there giving him a smoldering look, and he sat there placidly ignoring me until the boys moved off. After a couple more minutes passed, I gave up and said, "Tell me this. Why didn't you ask for help? I know you could have. They don't evict people overnight." He gave no sign that he'd heard me. "How the hell do we go about getting you out of here?" He went on looking through me as if I were air. I said, "Look, Ishmael, are you sore at me or something?" At last he gave me an eye, but it wasn't a very friendly one. "I didn't invite you to make yourself my patron," he said, "so kindly refrain from patronizing me." "You want me to mind my own business?"
"In a word, yes."
I looked around helplessly. "You mean you actually want to stay here?"
Once again, Ishmael's eye turned icy.
"All right, I told him, but what about me?"
"What about you?"
Well, we weren't finished, were we?
No, we weren't finished.
So, what are you going to do? Do I just become failure number five, or what?
He sat blinking at me sullenly for a minute or two, and then he said, "There's no need for you to become failure number five. We can continue as before."
At this point, a family strolled up to have a look at the most famous gorilla in the world. "So we can just continue as before, can we?" I said, and not in a whisper. "That strikes you as feasible, does it?"
The visitor suddenly found me much more interesting than Gargantua, who, after all, was just sitting there looking morose.
I said, "Well, where shall we begin? Do you remember where we left off?"
Intrigued, the visitors turned to see what response this would evoke from Ishmael. When it came, of course, only I could hear it. "Shut up."
"Shut up? I thought we were going to continue as before."
With a grunt, he shuffled to the rear of the cage and gave us a view of his back. The visitors decided I deserved a dirty look. They gave it to me and ambled off to the next attraction.
"Let me take you back," I said.
"No thanks," he replied. "Incredible as it may seem, I'd rather live this way than on anyone's largesse, even yours."
It'd only be largesse until we worked out something else.
"Something else being what? Doing stunts on The Tonight Show, a nightclub act?"
"Listen, if I can get in touch with the others, maybe we can work out some kind of joint effort."
"What the devil are you talking about?"
"I'm talking about the people who helped you get this far. You didn't do it by yourself, did you?"
He stared at me balefully from the shadows. "Go away," he snarled. "Just go away and leave me alone." I went away and left him alone.
I hadn't made plans for finding an Ishmael who didn't want to be rescued. I hadn't made plans for anything at all, in fact, so I didn't know what to do. I checked into the cheapest motel I could find and lay down to think things over. By 9 o'clock, I hadn't made any progress, so I went back to the carnival to see what was going on. I was in luck of sorts. A cold front was moving in, and a nasty light rain was sending the merrymakers home with their spirits dampened. "Do you suppose they're still called roustabouts?" I didn't ask the one I found closing down the sideshow tent. He looked to be about 80, and I offered him a 10 for the privilege of communing with the gorilla, who was no more gargantua than I was. He didn't appear to consider any of the ethical aspects of the matter, but sneered at the size of the bribe. I added another 10, and he left a light burning by the cage when he hobbled off. I dragged a folding chair over and sat down. Ishmael gazed at me for a few minutes, then asked where we had left off. "You just finished showing me that the story in Genesis that begins with the fall of Adam and ends with the murder of Abel is the story of our agricultural revolution as told by some of the earliest victims of that revolution.
And what remains, do you think?"
"I don't know. Maybe what remains is to bring it all together for me. I don't know what it all adds up to yet."
"Yes, I agree. Let me think for a bit." After a few minutes of head-scratching and earlobe tugging, however, Ishmael sent me away for the night. "I'm tired," he explained, "and I'm too cold to think."
The rain continued, and when I arrived at noon, I couldn't even find anyone to bribe. I picked up 2 blankets for Ishmael, and 1 for myself to keep him in countenance. We sat for a while, wallowing in our misery, then he reluctantly began.
"Shortly before my departure, you asked me when we were going to get to the story enacted by the Leavers."
"Yeah, that's right."
"Why are you interested in knowing that story?"
The question nonplussed me. Why wouldn't I be interested in knowing it?
"I'm asking what the point is in your mind. You know that Abel is all but dead. Why learn the story he was enacting?"
"Because we need to know it, because people can't just give up a story. That's what the kids tried in the 60s. They tried to stop living like takers, but there was no other way for them to live. They failed because you can't just stop being in a story. You have to have another story to be in."
Ishmael nodded. "And if there is such a story, people should hear about it?"
"Yes, they should."
"Do you think they want to hear about it?"
"I don't know. I don't think you can start wanting something till you know it exists."
"Very true,"
said Ishmael. Now, what do you suppose this story is about?
I have no idea.
Well, you should at least know that it's about the same things your story is about, the meaning of the world, divine intentions in the world, and the destiny of man.
Yes.
As I've said before, man became man enacting this story. What does that mean to you? Do you suppose a bunch of Australopithecines got together in the Olduvai Gorge and worked out a story to enact?
No.
Then what can it possibly mean that man became man enacting this story?
I chewed on that for a while and said, what I understand by it is that this story wasn't something he dreamed up. It was something built into his lifestyle.
Yes, that's it exactly. And how can we discover the story that was built into his lifestyle?
Predictably, I said, I didn't know.
Then I'll propose a hypothesis, Ishmael said. My hypothesis is this. Your agricultural revolution was a revolution against this story.
I groaned. I hope you're not expecting me to deduce the story from that.
It won't be so difficult. After all, you yourself embraced the spirit of your revolution. You wouldn't care to live the lifestyle of pre-revolutionary times, would you?
No, I wouldn't.
Therefore, on some level or other, you yourself must understand what your revolution was a revolution against.
I acknowledge that it was a clever argument.
What would you feel if you knew that tomorrow you'd awaken as a hunter-gatherer and never again live as you live now?
Wow, I suppose I'd feel terror.
Why?
Well, I don't know. I guess I'd expect to spend the rest of my life on the knife edge of survival.
Ishmael shook his head. Hunter-gatherers no more live on the knife edge of survival than wolves or lions. Pre-agricultural man was as well adapted to life on this planet as any other species. And the idea that he lived precariously is simply nonsense. If you like, you can confirm this for yourself in an afternoon at the library.
Okay, I said so.
So, now that you know this, does this life seem less repulsive to you?
Well, less repulsive, maybe, but still repulsive.
All right, let's try this. Whenever takers want to take some land occupied by leavers, they try to explain to them why they should abandon their lifestyle and become takers. They say, this life of yours is wretched and wrong. Man wasn't meant to live this way, so don't fight us. Join our revolution and help us turn the world into a paradise.
Right.
You take that part, the part of the cultural missionary, and I'll take the part of the hunter-gatherer. Explain to me why my life is grim and revolting and repulsive.
Good Lord.
I'll get you started. Buona, you say the way we live is wretched and wrong. You say it's not the way people are meant to live. This puzzles us, Buona, because for thousands of years it seemed to us a good way to live. But if you say it isn't, then we must in all prudence listen to what you have to say.
Well, I realize it seems good to you. This is because you're ignorant and uneducated and stupid.
Exactly so, Buona. We await your enlightenment. Tell us why our life is wretched and squalid and shameful.
Your life is wretched and squalid and shameful because you live like animals.
Ishmael frowned, puzzled. I don't understand, Buona. We live as all others live. We take what we need from the world and leave the rest alone, just as the lion and the deer do. Do the lion and the deer lead shameful lives?
No, that's because they're just animals. It's not right for humans to live that way.
Ah, Ishmael said, this we did not know. And why is it not right to live that way?
It's because living that way, you have no control over your lives.
Ishmael cocked his head at me. In what sense do we have no control over our lives, Buona?
You have no control over the most basic necessity of all, your food supply.
You puzzle me greatly, Buona. When we are hungry, we go off and find something to eat. What more control is needed?
You'd have more control if you planted it yourself.
How so, Buona? What does it matter who plants the food?
If you plant it yourself, then you know positively that it's going to be there.
Ishmael cackled delightedly. Truly, you astonish me, Buona. We already know positively that it's going to be there. The whole world of life is food. Is it going to sneak away in the night? Where would it go? It's always there, day after day. And if it weren't, we wouldn't be here to talk to you about it.
Yes, but if you planted it yourself, you could control how much food there was. You'd be able to say, well, this year we'll have more yams. This year we'll have more beans.
Bwana, these things grow in abundance without the slightest effort on our part. Why should we trouble ourselves to plant what is already growing?
Yes, but don't you ever run out? Don't you ever wish you had a yam, but find there are no more growing wild?
Yes, I suppose so. But isn't it the same for you? Don't you ever wish you had a yam, but find there are no more growing in your fields?
No, because if we wish we had a yam, we can go to the store and buy a can of them.
Yes, I have heard something of this. Among my people, when we want a yam, we simply go and dig one up. And if there are none to be found, we find something else just as good.
You're missing the point.
I certainly am, Bwana.
I stifled a sigh. Look, here's the point. Unless you control your own food supply, you live at the mercy of the gods. That's just not a human way to live.
Why is that, Bwana?
Well, look, one day you go out hunting and you catch a deer. Okay, that's fine, that's terrific. But you didn't have any control over the deer's being there, did you?
No, Bwana.
Okay, next day you go out hunting and there's no deer to be caught. Hasn't that ever happened?
Assuredly, Bwana.
Well, there you are. Because you have no control over the deer, you have no deer. So what do?
Ishmael shrugged. We snare a couple of rabbits.
Exactly. You shouldn't have to settle for rabbits if what you want is deer.
And this is why we lead shameful lives, Bwana?
This is why we should set aside a life we love and go to work in one of your factories because we eat rabbits when it happens that no deer presents itself to us?
No, let me finish. You have no control over the deer and no control over the rabbits either. Suppose you go out hunting one day and there are no deer and no rabbits. What then?
Then we eat something else. The world is full of food.
But look, if you don't control any of it... I bared my teeth at him. Look, there's no guarantee the world is always going to be full of food. Haven't you ever had a drought?
Certainly, Bwana.
Well, what happens then?
The grasses wither, all the plants wither, the trees bear no fruit, the game disappears, the predators dwindle. If the drought is very bad, then we too dwindle.
You mean you die, don't you?
Certainly, Bwana.
Ha! That's the point!
It's shameful to die, Bwana?
No, I've got it. Look, this is the point. You die because you live at the mercy of the gods. You die because you think the gods are going to look after you.
We should not trust the gods with our lives?
Definitely not. You should trust yourselves with your lives. That's the human way to live.
Ah, this is sorry news indeed, Bwana. From time out of mind, we've lived in the hands of the gods and thought we lived well. We left to them all the labor of sowing and growing and lived a carefree life. And it seemed there was always enough in the world for us because, behold, we are here.
Yes, I told him sternly. You're here, and look at you. You have nothing. You're naked and homeless. You live without security, without comfort, without opportunity.
And this is because we live in the hands of the gods?
Absolutely. In the hands of the gods, you're no more important than lions or lizards or fleas. This is why you've got to take your lives out of their hands entirely. You've got to take your lives into your own hands.
And how do we do that, Bwana?
As I say, you've got to begin planting your own food.
But how will that change anything, Bwana? Food is food, whether we plant it or the gods plant it.
That's exactly the point. The gods plant only what you need. You will plant more than you need.
To what end, Bwana? What's the good of having more food than we need?
Damn! I shouted. I get it!
Ishmael smiled and said, "So what's the good of having more food than we need?"
That is the whole goddamn point. When you have more food than you need, then the gods have no power over you.
We can thumb our noses at them.
Exactly.
All the same, Bwana, what are we to do with this food if we don't need it?
You save it. You save it to thwart the gods when they decide it's your turn to go hungry. You save it so that when they send a drought, you can say, "Not me, goddammit, I'm not going hungry. And there's nothing you can do about it, because my life is in my own hands now."
Ishmael nodded, shedding his role as hunter-gatherer.
"Mother culture teaches that your revolution was basically just a technological advance, but now you see that it served and continues to serve a powerful mythological function. It was a revolution that put you beyond the reach of the gods."
"Yes, that's it."
So we have a new pair of names for you. The takers are those who know good and evil, and the leavers are... The leavers are those who live in the hands of the gods. Along about 3 o'clock, the rain stopped and the carnival yawned, stretched, and went back to work separating the rubes from their money. At loose ends again, I hung around for a while, let myself be separated from a few bucks, and finally had the idea of tracking down Ishmael's owner. This turned out to be a hard-eyed black man named Art Owens, who was 5 feet tall and spent more time lifting weights than I do at the typewriter. I told him I was interested in buying his gorilla.
"Is that a fact?" he said.
Not scornful, not impressed, not interested, not anything. I told him it was, and asked how much it would take.
"Would take about 3,000.
"I'm not that interested."
"How interested are you?"
"Just curious."
"Well, more like 1,000.
He sneered, just a little, almost politely. For some reason I liked this guy. He was the type who has a law degree from Harvard stuck away in a drawer somewhere because he never found anything to do with it that appealed to him.
"Might go to 2,500, he said.
"I could possibly raise 15.
"Don't see how I could go below 22, that's a fact."
If it was right there in my hand, I thought he'd take 2 grand, maybe even 1,800. I said I'd think about it. It was a Friday night, so the suckers didn't start going home till after 11, and my bribee didn't come around to collect his 20 till midnight. Ishmael was asleep, sitting up, still bundled in his blankets, and I didn't feel any qualms about waking him. I wanted him to reassess the charms of independence. He yawned, sneezed twice, cleared his throat of a mass of phlegm, and fixed me in a bleary, malevolent glare.
"Come back tomorrow," he croaked.
"Tomorrow's Saturday. Hopeless." He wasn't happy about it, but he knew I was right. He managed to put off the inevitable by laboriously rearranging himself, his cage, and his blankets, and then he settled down and gave me a look of loathing.
"Where did we leave off?"
"We left off with a new pair of names for the takers and the leavers, those who know good and evil, and those who live in the hands of the gods," he grunted.
"What happens to people who live in the hands of the gods?"
"What do you mean?"
"Before you were homo, you were what?"
"Australopithecus."
"Good. And how did Australopithecus become homo? Did he do it by saying, 'We know good and evil as well as the gods, so there's no need for us to live in their hands like rabbits. From now on, we'll decide who lives and who dies on this planet, not the gods.' Could he have become man by saying that?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because he would have ceased to be subject to the conditions under which evolution takes place."
"Exactly. Now you can answer the question, what happens to people who live in the hands of the gods?"
"Oh, yes, I see. They evolve."
"And now, how did man become man?"
"Man became man by living in the hands of the gods."
"By living the way the Bushmen of Africa live. By living the way the Krina Krore of Brazil live."
"That's right."
"Not the way the Chicagoans live. Not the way Londoners live."
"No.
So now you know what happens to people who live in the hands of the gods."
"Yes, they evolve. Because they're in a position to evolve, because in the hands of the gods is where evolution happens."
"And that's why it all happened, why Australopithecus became Homo habilis, and why Homo habilis became Homo erectus, and why Homo erectus became Homo sapiens, and why Homo sapiens became Homo sapiens sapiens."
"Yes."
"And then what happened?"
"Then the takers said, 'We've had enough of living in the hands of the gods. No more natural selection for us, thanks very much.'"
"And that was that. You remember I said that to enact a story is to live so as to make it come true?"
"Yes."
"According to the Taker story, creation came to an end with man. How would you live so as to make that come true? How would you live to make creation come to an end with man?"
"Oh, good Lord, I see what you mean.
You would live the way the Takers live. We're definitely living in a way that's going to put an end to creation. If we go on, there will be no successor to man, no successor to chimpanzees, no successor to gorillas, no successor to anything alive now.
The whole thing is going to come to an end with us. In order to make their story come true, the Takers have to put an end to creation itself. And they're doing a damn good job of it.
When we began, and I was trying to help you find the premise of the Taker's story, I told you the Lever story has an entirely different premise. Perhaps you're ready to articulate it now. The premise of the Taker's story is the world belongs to man. Can you figure out the premise of the Lever's story? I thought for a couple of minutes, and then I laughed. It's almost too neat. The premise of the Lever story is man belongs to the world.
Meaning what?
Meaning... I barked a laugh. It's really too much, meaning that right from the beginning, everything that ever lived belonged to the world. And that's how things came to be this way. Those single-celled creatures that swam in the ancient oceans belonged to the world, and because they did, everything that followed came into being. Those club-finned fish offshore of the continents belonged to the world, and because they did, the amphibians came into being. And because the amphibians belonged to the world, the reptiles came into being. And because the reptiles belonged to the world, the mammals came into being. And because the mammals belonged to the world, the primates came into being. And because the primates belonged to the world, Australopithecus came into being. And because Australopithecus belonged to the world, man came into being. And for 3 million years, man belonged to the world, and because he belonged to the world, he grew and developed and became brighter and more dexterous, until one day he was so bright and so dexterous that we had to call him Homo sapiens sapiens, which means he was us. And that's the way the Levers lived for 3 million years, as if they belonged to the world.
That's right, and that's how we came into being.
Ishmael said, "We know what happens if you take the Taker premise that the world belongs to man. That's a disaster. And what happens if you take the Lever premise that man belongs to the world? Well, then creation goes on forever. How does that sound?"
"It has my vote."
"Something occurs to me," I said. "It occurs to me that the story I just told is, in fact, the story the Levers have been enacting here for 3 million years. The Taker's story is... the gods made the world for man, but they botched the job, so we had to take matters into our own more competent hands. The Lever's story is the gods made man for the world, the same way they made salmon and sparrows for the world. This seems to have worked well so far, so we can take it easy and leave the running of the world to the gods."
"That's right," Ishmael said.
"There are other ways to tell it, just as there are other ways to tell the story of the Takers, but this is as good as any."
I sat there for a while. I'm thinking about the meaning of the world, divine intentions in the world, and the destiny of man, according to this story.
"Go ahead," Ishmael said.
"The meaning of the world, I think the 3rd chapter of Genesis had it right. It's a garden, the God's garden. And there are 2 trees in the garden, one for the gods and one for us. The one for them is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the one for us is the tree of life. But we can only find that tree if we stay in the garden. And we can only stay in the garden if we keep our hands off the God's tree."
Ishmael gave me a nod of encouragement.
"Divine intentions. It would seem this is sort of tendency in evolution, wouldn't you say? If you start with those ultra-simple critters in the ancient seas and move up step by step to everything we see here now and beyond, then you have to observe a tendency toward complexity and toward self-awareness and intelligence, wouldn't you agree? All sorts of creatures here seem to be on the verge of attaining that self-awareness and intelligence. So it's not just humans that the gods are after. We were never meant to be the only players on this stage. The gods intend this planet to be a garden filled with creatures that are self-aware and intelligent."
"So it would appear," said Ishmael. "And if this is so, then man's destiny would seem to be plain."
"Yes," I answered. "Amazingly enough, it is plain. Man is the trailblazer, the pathfinder. His destiny is to be the first to learn that creatures like man have a choice. They can try to thwart the gods and perish in the attempt, or they can stand aside and make some room for all the rest. But it's more than that. His destiny is to be the father of them all. I don't mean by direct descent,
by giving the rest their chance, the whales and the dolphins and the chimps and the raccoons, he becomes, in some sense, their progenitor. Oddly enough, it's even grander than the destiny the Takers dreamed up for us. Just think, in a billion years, whatever is around then, whoever is around then, says, "Man? Oh, yes, man! What a wonderful creature he was! It was within his power to destroy the world and to trample all our futures into the dust. But he saw the light before it was too late. He pulled back and gave the rest of us our chance. He showed us all how it had to be done if the world was to go on being a garden forever. Man was the role model for us all."
"Not a shabby destiny," Ishmael remarked.
"Not a shabby destiny by any means. And it occurs to me that this gives a little shape to the story. The world is a very, very fine place. It wasn't a mess. It didn't need to be conquered and ruled by man. The world doesn't need to belong to man, but it does need man to belong to it. Some creature had to be the first to go through this, had to see that there were two trees in the garden, one that was good for gods and one that was good for creatures. Some creature had to find the way, and if that happened, then there was just no limit to what could happen here. In other words, man does have a place in the world, but it's not his place to rule. The gods have that in hand. Man's place is to be the first. Man's place is to be the first without being the last. Man's place is to figure out how to do that, and then to make some room for all the rest. And maybe when the time comes, it's man's place to be the teacher of those who are capable of becoming what he's become. Not the only teacher, not the ultimate teacher, maybe only the first teacher, the kindergarten teacher. But even that wouldn't be too shabby. And do you know what? All along, I've been saying to myself, yes, this is all very interesting, but what good is it? This isn't going to change anything.
And now?
This is what we need, not just stopping things, not just less. People need something positive to work for. They need a vision of something that, I don't know, something that...
I think what you're groping for is that people need more than to be scolded, more than to be made to feel stupid and guilty. They need more than a vision of doom. They need a vision of the world and of themselves that inspires them.
Yes, that's right.
I trust you now see a point I made when we first began. The story being enacted here by the Takers is not in any sense chapter 2 of the story that was being enacted here during the first 3 million years of human life. The Lever story has its own chapter 2.
What is its chapter 2?
You've just outlined it, haven't you? We'll never know what the Levers of Europe and Asia were up to when the Takers came along to plow them under forever, but we do know what they were up to here in North America. They were looking for ways to achieve settlement that were in accord with the way they'd always lived, ways that left room for the rest of life to go on around them. I don't mean they did this out of high-mindedness. It didn't occur to them to take the life of the world into their own hands and to declare war on the life around them. Proceeding in this way for another 5,000 or 10,000 years, a dozen civilizations might have appeared on this continent, as sophisticated as yours is now, each with its own values and objectives. It's not unthinkable.
No, it's not. But this raises an important question. What exactly would it mean to belong to the world at this point? Obviously, you're not saying that only hunter-gatherers truly belong to the world.
Certainly not. Though if the Bushmen of Africa or the Kalapalo of Brazil want to go on living that way for the next 10 million years, I can't see how this can be anything less than beneficial for them and for the world.
True, but that doesn't answer my question. How can civilized people belong to the world?
Ishmael shook his head in exasperation. Civilized has nothing to do with it. The creatures around Australopithecus didn't imagine that the world belonged to them, so they let him live and grow. How does being civilized come into it? Does being civilized mean that you have to destroy the world? Does being civilized make you incapable of giving the creatures around you a little space in which to live?
No.
Does it make you incapable of living as harmlessly as sharks and tarantulas and rattlesnakes? Does it make you incapable of following a law that even snails and earthworms manage to follow without any difficulty?
No.
As I said some time ago, human settlement isn't against the law, it's subject to the law. And the same is true of civilization.
So what exactly is your question?
I don't know now. Obviously, belonging to the world means belonging to the same club as everyone else. The club being the community of life. It means belonging to the club and following the same rules as everyone else.
And if being civilized means anything at all, it should mean that you're leaders of the club, not its only criminals and destroyers.
True, but I do have another question, I added.
Proceed.
Your ad said, must earnestly desire to save the world.
Yes.
What do I do if I earnestly desire to save the world?
Ishmael frowned at me through the bars for a long moment. You want a program?
Of course I want a program.
Then here is a program. The story of Genesis must be undone. First, Cain must stop murdering Abel. This is essential if you're to survive. The leavers are the endangered species most critical to the world, not because they're humans, but because they alone can show the destroyers of the world that there is more than one right way to live. And then, of course, you must spit out the fruit of that forbidden tree. You must absolutely and forever relinquish the idea that you know who should live and who should die on this planet.
Yes, I see all that, but that's a program for mankind. That's not a program for me. What do I do?
What you do is to teach 100 what I've taught you, and inspire each of them to teach 100. That's how it's always done.
I shook my head. You're saying someone has to become to the world of today what St. Paul was to the Roman Empire.
Yes, basically. Is that so daunting?
I laughed. Daunting isn't nearly strong enough. To call it daunting is like calling the Atlantic damp.
Even though we'd only been talking an hour or so, Ishmael seemed limp with exhaustion. I made tentative noises about leaving, but he evidently had something more on his mind. At last he looked up and said,
"You understand that I'm finished with you."
It would have felt about the same if he'd plunged a knife into my stomach. He closed his eyes for a moment.
"Pardon me. I'm tired and befuddled. I didn't mean that the way it came out."
I couldn't answer him, but managed a nod.
"I mean only that I've finished what I set out to do. As a teacher, I have nothing more to give you."
Again, I couldn't manage more than a nod.
Ishmael shrugged and looked around bleary-eyed, as if he'd momentarily forgotten where he was. Then he reared back and exploded in a magnificently juicy sneeze.
"Look," I said, getting up, "I'll be back tomorrow."
He gave me a long, dark stare. He was wondering what the devil more I expected of him, but was too weary to ask. He sent me on my way with a grunt and a valedictory nod.
That night, awaiting sleep in my motel bed, I finalized my plan. I knew it was a bad plan, but couldn't think of anything better. Whether he liked it or not, and I knew he wouldn't, I had to rescue Ishmael from that goddamn carnival. It was a bad plan in another sense, in that it depended entirely on me and my meager resources. I had only one hole card, and if I had to turn it, it would probably be a deuce. At 9 the next morning, I was looking for breakfast in a small town about halfway home when a too-hot warning lit up my dashboard. I made it to a filling station where the guy on duty was willing to poke around a little.
"Radiator fan isn't working,"
he told me after about 15 seconds. He ruled out a blown fuse by trying a new one, which did no better. He said, "Hold on," and fetched a pen-type probe, which he used to test the plug connecting the fan to the electrical system.
"You got fire to the fan," he told me, "so it looks like it's the fan itself that shot."
"Where can I get a new one?"
"Here in town? Nowhere," he told me, "not on a Saturday. But you can get home with it as it is if you stop and let it cool down whenever it starts to overheat."
I made it back and got the car into a garage before noon. I had only one errand to run, and that was to one of those dear little money machines, where I plundered all my resources, checking, savings, credit cards.
When I got home, I was carrying $2,400 and was otherwise a pauper. I didn't intend to think about the problems ahead because they were just too tough. How do you get a half-ton gorilla out of a cage he doesn't care to vacate? How do you get Sam into the backseat of a car he doesn't care to ride in? Would a car with a half-ton gorilla in the backseat even function? As this indicates, I'm a one-step-at-a-time kind of guy, an improviser. Somehow or another, I'd get Ishmael stashed in the backseat of my car. Then I'd figure out what to do next. Presumably, I'd bring him back to my apartment. And then again, figure out what next. In my experience, you never really know how to handle a problem till you actually have it. They called at 9 on Monday morning to tell me what was what with the car. The fan had gone out because it was overtaxed. It was overtaxed because the whole damn cooling system was shot. About $600 would fix it. I told them to carry on and said I'd pick it up when I could. I was already working on a new plan. I couldn't afford the repairs, and the damn thing probably wouldn't be up to carrying Ishmael anyway. So I rented a van. You will doubtless wonder why in hell I didn't do that in the first place. The answer is I just didn't think of it. I'm limited, okay? 2 hours later, I pulled up at the carnival lot and said, damn. The carnival had moved on. Something, maybe a premonition, prompted me to get out and poke around. The lot seemed much too small to have held 19 rides, 24 games, and a sideshow. I wondered if I could find the site of Ishmael's cage without any landmarks to guide me. My feet remembered enough to get me to the vicinity, and my eyes did the rest. For there was a visible trace. The blankets I'd bought for him had been left behind, had been dumped in a messy pile. Along with other things, I recognized a few of his books and the poster from his office, now rolled up and secured by a rubber band. I was stirring it up and sorting it out in a bewildered way when my aged bribee turned up. He grinned and held up a big black plastic bag to show me what he was doing, clearing away the hundreds of pounds of trash that had been left behind. Then, when he saw the pile of stuff at my feet, he looked up at me and said, "It was the pneumonia."
"What?"
"It was the pneumonia that got him. Your friend, the ape." I stood there blinking at him, unable to fathom what he was getting at.
"Vet came Saturday night and shot him full of stuff, but it was too late. Passed off this morning around 7, I guess."
"Are you telling me that he's dead?"
"Dead's what he is, partner."
And I, the total egotist, had only vaguely registered the fact that he seemed listless. I looked around the vast gray lot where the wind raised clumps of trash and sent them tumbling, and felt one with it. Empty, useless, choked with dust, a wasteland. My ancient partner waited, interested to see what this friend of apes would do or say next.
"And what did they do with him?" I asked.
"Huh?
What did they do with the body?"
"Oh, called the county, I guess. Took him off to where they cremate the road kills, you know."
"Yeah, thanks."
"No sweat."
I left the blankets, of course, but the rest all fit easily under one arm. What was to be done? Stand for a moment with lowered gaze outside the county furnace where they cremate the road kills? Someone else would have handled it differently, probably better, revealing a greater heart, a finer sensibility. Myself, I drove home. Drove home, turned in the van, picked up my car, and went back to the apartment. It was empty in a new way, with a new degree of emptiness. There was a telephone there on an end table connecting me to a whole world of life and activity. But who could I call? Oddly enough, I thought of someone, looked up a number and dialed it. After 3 rings, a low, firm voice answered, "Mrs. Sokolov's residence."
"Is this Mr. Partridge?"
"Yes, this is Mr. Partridge."
I said, "This is the guy who visited you a couple of weeks ago, trying to locate Rachel Sokolov."
Partridge waited.
I said, "Ishmael's dead."
After a pause, "I'm sorry to hear it."
"We could have saved him."
Partridge thought about that for a while. "Are you sure he would have let us?" I wasn't sure and said so.
Thank you.
It wasn't till I got Ishmael's poster to the framing shop that I discovered there were messages on both sides. I had it framed so both can be seen. The message on one side is the one Ishmael displayed on the wall of his den. With man gone, will there be hope for gorilla? The message on the other side reads, with gorilla gone, will there be hope for man? This is Anthony Heald. We hope you have enjoyed this Turner Bantam Audio production of Ishmael. Abridgment by Daniel Quinn. Produced by David Rapkin. Directed by Lars Howell. Copyright 1992, Bantam Audio Publishing.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.